Well, we are going to proceed. I'll let the folks in the audience know that we are going to defer items 32 and 33, which are status reports. They'll be dealt with at the next board meeting. We are going to defer 37 reports by our board members. Mr. Briggs, what about the Basin Plan Triennial Review List Update? Is that something that you felt that we needed to deal with at this board meeting?
We should ask if there's anyone here for that item. Is anyone here for item 35?
Anyone in the audience?
Basin Plan Triennial Review Update. That being the case, we should probably defer that.
Okay, so we will defer that one also. How about anyone here on public forum? Does anyone want to address the board on any item that is not on the agenda?
Why don't we just do that? Because it may be zip.
Well, anyway. We are right now.
Right now? Okay.
If no one comes forward and wants to address this, then we've just dealt with that item. Okay. That then leaves us with just these two items on our agenda, 25 and 26. And Mr. Kolb, would you like to present those? Well, 25 first.
Thank you, Chairman Young. I ambitiously put good afternoon, but I will start with good evening, Chairman Young, members of the board. Roger. I am Howard Kolb, and I have the...
Time out. We actually are going to take 25 and 26 together, correct?
Yes, we are.
Okay.
Now you can go.
Okay. I have the pleasure of working on the timber harvest program. I've been working on it since approximately September of 2004, and I previously worked in the program in the mid to late 90s. Today I'd like to discuss items 25 and 26, 25 being the negative declaration for item 26, which is the general waiver of waste discharge requirements, which we are referring to as the timber harvest requirements. Today, staff is asking for two outcomes. The first would be the adoption of the proposed negative declaration for the proposed project, and the second one being adoption of the project. The timber harvest requirements, the proposed project, also includes the monitoring program, and it is item number 0066. The proposed order, the requirements are conditional, or the timber harvest requirements, the proposed project, the requirements are conditional. Projects that comply with the requirements would not adversely affect water quality and would be in the public interest. And I want to point out the projects under this general conditional waiver can be terminated at any time by the executive officer or the water board. I want to point out that if you have coverage under the timber harvest requirements, which we have referred to as tiers 1, 2, and 3, the same order applies for all activities, regardless of the monitoring level that you have. Also, all the order provisions conditions apply to all activities. So it's the same order for all plans. If a proposed plan cannot meet the conditions of the order, it cannot get coverage under the timber harvest requirements and would have to go to an individual order or a individual waiver. The proposed project protects beneficial uses by prohibiting pollution, requiring monitoring, and allow board access to inspect what's going on out in the field. Since November or October 15th, which is the winter season, staff has conducted 10 post-harvest inspections, and I don't have the exact number of pre-harvest inspections, but at least 7 or 8 pre-harvest inspections at this point. The proposed project requires or protects beneficial uses by requiring an approved THP or NTMP by the Department of Forestry. This is a It's a multidisciplinary team process. It allows public comment and also allows inspections before the plan is sent to CDF for final approval. It also requires the discharger or the property owner to maintain beneficial uses and install management practices and maintain those management practices to protect water quality. Again, the proposed water quality program, the main components of the program are the inspections, the input from the multidisciplinary team, the ranking and screening using the eligibility criteria. And if you recall from February of this year, we had a detailed discussion on the eligibility criteria and the proposed monitoring levels. I want to point out that staff inspects or conducts pre-harvest inspections of all THPs prior to recommending a waiver to this board. That's the process that has gone on up to this point. And if the timber harvest requirements are approved today, staff intends to continue that process of inspecting all plans prior to issuance of any order. Coverage under the order. Again, I talked about the multidisciplinary team. This includes representatives from Fish and Game, from the California Board of Forestry, California Geologic Survey, water purveyors from local watersheds, and county representatives. The staff also conducts review of monitoring reports. It's the use of that information plus the eligibility criteria plus compliance history that staff uses in determining whether or not a coverage is appropriate under the proposed project, the proposed timber harvest requirements. I just wanted to briefly go over the monitoring tiers that are included in the proposed project. There's three tiers. The first tier is forest practice compliance rules, and this is CDF's inspections of the plan, and this actually applies to all three tiers. They have to go through the forest practice compliance rules. And if a problem is observed under Tier 1, you have to do forensic monitoring. And again, forensic monitoring also applies to the other two tiers, and that's if you see a problem, you have to address it with management practices immediately and then document that back to the board. Tier 2 also includes visual and photo documentation. And then Tier 3 includes visual photo documentation as well as turbidity and temperature monitoring. Although individual waivers are not included in the proposed timber harvest requirements, we always have that option, and that option has been referred to as Tier 4. This is the typical level of monitoring that would apply to most plans. And the reason I say typical is it's a matrix, and that's the way things might fall out. I want to point out on one of the plans that the board approved this morning, Lands of Walsh Fletcher, it would have fallen into a Tier 2 condition and in terms of a Tier 3, but there were no Class 2s or Class 1s on the proposed harvest area. However, there were 13 Class 3s that drained into a Class 1, and I talked to the foresters, and it was agreed that they would put temperature and turbidity monitoring in that Class 1. So although, according to the conditions of the order as proposed, they weren't required to have turbidity and temperature, based on our pre-harvest inspection discussion with the foresters, we determined that it would be more appropriate to have a higher level of monitoring. And I want to stress that it's a process. We don't use just the eligibility criteria. We look at a bunch of different factors when we're making these determinations. As I said, we had presented the eligibility criteria as a clear and transparent process, as a way or one tool that we use to go through, and it helps us establish what the appropriate level of monitoring should be. And we use this on all THPs and NTMPs, and the reason I'm mentioning NTMPs is once an NTMP is approved, they might come back to us in 3 to 5 years for a second portion of that plan. For example, the Big Basin Water Company that was approved back in March, that was for two components of that NTMP, and they will probably be coming back in the next few years for a second one. And again, they will have to get coverage under the waiver for that other entry into the NTMP. This is a picture of the eligibility criteria. You've seen that before. It was included. We've run through it for each individual waiver that we've proposed to the board before, and I don't want to spend a lot of time with this because we covered it in February. The proposed order, the timber harvest requirement, requires that let me back up just a little second. Beginning in 2003, we've had extensive discussions with the board regarding regulation, and it made it clear that we needed the eligibility criteria to illustrate how we go through the process of evaluating THPs and NTMPs. The eligibility criteria was developed in response to what processes we should use to help set monitoring levels. The eligibility criteria involved a series of actions. We had workshops. We've issued approximately 27 individual waivers in the past, and we went back and compared those and ran them through the eligibility criteria, and we presented some of those results back in February. We also have our post-harvest, pre-harvest inspections, data analysis, enforcement. We issued two NOVs this past winter for failure to comply with forest practice rules. And then the overall process has been revised over the last 4 to 8 months based on a steady stream of comments that staff has received since December. And the board got 50 pages of comment and response that staff has prepared. And you'll see a little bit later in the presentation how we've incorporated some of those comments into changing the eligibility criteria, changing some conditions in the order, and changing some issues in the monitoring reporting program. I want to stress that all parties that I've talked to with regards to the general order are supportive of resource protection. Everyone is supportive of proper management of the resources. The real crux is how much and how do you make sure that that's happening. Staff believes that compliance with the conditions of the order will protect water quality and associated beneficial uses. The order requires protection in that the dischargers will comply with the water quality control plans. They'll not create pollution. They'll not discharge other than what's allowed under the order. They shall not cause alteration in stream temperatures. They shall take immediate action to repair any problems that they see, and all erosion and sediment control devices will be installed and maintained for the term of the waiver or timber harvest requirements. I'd like to point out a couple specific items that we've added. We added a finding to the order that said if a non-concurrence has been filed by a resource agency related to water quality, that has to be resolved prior to the waiver being taking effect. There will be some of the resource professionals asked that language be clarified to say that it be resolved during the CDF process, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. And also with the skid trails, we added a finding that said you can't get coverage under the waiver if skid trails are not mapped. The reason we did this is the forest practice rules state that on slopes less than 50%, there's a setback from water courses that are also incorporated in that. They don't have to actually map the skid trails where tractor operations will occur. And staff felt that this wasn't being captured in the soil disturbance factor under the eligibility criteria. So we put this in. However, some of the resource professionals said that have indicated that that's somewhat limiting to their ability to manage the property appropriately, and they are going to propose some alternative language, which I'll present in just a few minutes. The proposed monitoring program that we developed was targeted at specific questions. We gave examples of those in February. We talked about the tiers again and what they were in February. Now I'd like to shift gears just a little bit and kind of go to our current state of knowledge. I just want to say before we launch off onto that staff is proposing that we evaluate the data we collect over the next 24 months and return to the board with a report on what we know. And we received a letter also from the resource professionals that said they would like that report within 30 months of approval of this of these timber harvest requirements. So I know you didn't want to see any more BMPs that weren't working, but I did want to show that we are aware that there have been problems in the past. Some of the evidence submitted by some of the parties regarding the CEQA conditions on item 25 cited failed management measures, and staff has gone back and looked at that evidence, and these are a couple examples of the items that were included in their package. These are failures, but the proposed project is for NTMPs and THPs that comply with the conditions of the order. So if we see this, this is an obvious enforcement action for us. Most of the evidence submitted by parties predates the proposed project, which would be January of 2003 is what I believe we've started to implement some different actions at the board with individual waivers. Staff takes these kinds of issues very seriously. One plan that staff is familiar with is the Gamecock plan that was in 1996. It was a violation. Staff went back and reviewed CDF files and noted that CDF conducted 29 inspections on that, issued 13 violations, and the individuals that were operating on that plan in terms of the four the harvesters, the licensed timber operators, are no longer operating in the county. In addition to that, regional board made four inspections to that property during the same period. We issued a 13267 letter, which required them to develop a plan, an implementation plan, and an implementation schedule with dates, and give that to us, and then a report confirming implementation. And we did get all that, and we went back and looked at the record just to confirm, and it was there. And we know that they've implemented management practices and some the planting of the riparian corridor back in 96-97. So what can we say about current conditions? You'll recall back in February we showed this one graph, the big blue solid line. That is the turbidity readings down at Tate Street collected by the City of Santa Cruz. This dot right here is the crossing off of THP in the upper watershed. It's a Class 2 crossing that drains into this Class 1 that flows through the property. Here's the values of this plan upstream and downstream. These are I'm just going to go to this plan real quickly. There's the upstream station. There's the downstream station. There's the Class 2 water course coming in. And let me just go back so you can look at that. And again, you can't really say based on this information that, what you can say is the water coming off the Class 2 does not appear to be adversely changing the level of turbidity in the Class 1 flowing through the property. That's what you can say. I want to give a couple more examples. We came up with a pretty cool little graph that I want to show you guys. And we have three rain stations. Here is the Ben Lomond Mountain Station right here. Here's the Ben Lomond Lower Station, and then here's the Las Cumbres Rain Station. And the reason I put that in is you'll see in the monitoring, the reporting program, we're requiring one of the change was to include information on range gauge station. That's the location of the Kings Creek plan, and then this is the Tate Street plan down at the bottom. Again, here's the plan with the Class 2. The upstream, downstream on Class 1 flows in this direction. Now, this graph, I apologize because it's somewhat busy, but there's a lot of really cool information here. These two big blue ones, these are from the City of Santa Cruz. That's their continuous turbidity read down at the bottom of the drainage. This yellow, red, and green line, those are the various rain stations. So the yellow line is the Las Cumbres. And going back, the Las Cumbres is on the back of this ridge. This is the Ben Lomond. And typically your storms are coming in off the Pacific. And when they hit this Ben Lomond station, you can see that it's getting almost twice as much rain as the Las Cumbres, or not twice as much, almost an inch and a half more. So it's getting about 4.7. The Las Cumbres is getting about 3.2. Likewise, on the second storm, it's getting 2. The upper one's getting about 4.1, and the Ben Lomond Mountain is getting about 4.3. So as it comes over, it hits that ridge, drops a lot of water, goes down, drops more water through the valley, and then by the time it gets up to the top, And this is important because depending on where your plant is in the watershed and its responsiveness to the rainstorms, and the foresters know this because they've talked to me about this very information. What I'd like to show too is here are two samples taken upstream and downstream again. At this, here's the downstream, here's the upstream. And you can see they're running at about 485 on the upstream and 469 on the downstream. Those numbers are probably not different in terms of statistics, but since we don't have more than one set of numbers for that spot, you can't say whether or not they're statistically significantly different. But and then if you look down, I have to look at my graph because my eyes aren't that good. If you look down right here, that's what's coming off the class 2, that dot, and it's running about 194, 195. And so again, what you can say based on that information is the class 2 does not appear to be changing the turbidity in class 1. That does not mean that the class 2 turbidity levels are appropriate. It just says that they're not changing what you see in the class 1. What's really nice about this is we have this continuous data from the city of Santa Cruz, which shows that this information was collected on the rising limb, or when the storm was happening. These data points over here from the same plan were collected on the falling limb. And you can see that these are at 2.4 coming off the plan, and then in the upstream, downstream, they're 13, 14 NTUs. And at the down at Tate Street, it's at about 106 NTUs. You can see that over there. So it's really beneficial to have some of that continuous information so that you can kind of place where your samples are from. But again, getting this kind of continuous information is very expensive. There, we are going to be able to get some out of the Little Creek study. We have this site at the city. It would be nice to have a few more. So staff has been trying to look at more data because that's been sort of a gap in our analysis. This is two plans that we looked at for temperature. This is the melee plan, upstream, downstream, and these as RMC plans, upstream, downstream. Both these plans have waiver requirements, as does the Kings Creek plan, which I just showed. This is a graphic for the RMC plan. That's over here on this branch. And again, the water's flowing down this way. They both connect into the San Vicente Creek. What's interesting to note is these graphs, the blue line is the upstream and the yellow line is the downstream.
You know, it might be more useful to plot the difference between those two.
We'll get there. The temperature range on these are between 10 and 16 degrees. We just haven't quite done that yet, but which for the uninitiated in Celsius, that's 50 to 61 Fahrenheit. And what's interesting is they pretty much track each other, and you can see that there's an increasing temperature range to right here about at the end of September, and then we got some kind of cold spell. There is one point where the upstream is actually warmer than the downstream. You can't really say that the plan is, or that the timber harvest area was cooling the water, or what's actually happening upstream. But it's just interesting to note that they're paralleling one another. And we are looking for more data so we can get a better feel. And I have a couple more graphs I want to show you. This is off the melee plan. You can see it, too, had the same behavioral characteristics as what's happening on the RMC plan. Now, this is some data that we pulled up from, I believe, USGS. And it's from 1969 through 1993 at the Big Tree Station, which is down in the lower part of the San Lorenzo River. And these dots are the winter temperatures, the clearer ones, and then the purple ones are summer temperatures. What's interesting is you can see a band of temperature for summer and a band of temperature for winter, and that what we saw in the San Vicente Creek going between 10 and 16 degrees is falling in that range. But that's about all you can say. We still have a lot more research to do. We've also grabbed some of our own C-Camp data to show that The black dots are the average values, and the blue lines are the means. Each one of these stations has somewhere between 35 and 40 data points associated with it. These were all taken at the mouths of these creeks, and each one of these sites is not directly comparable in the sense that Waddell Creek is a much larger estuary than, say, Gazos Creek. But it, again, they're running between the 10 and the 16 range, so we're just trying to get an understanding of what's really happening out there in temperature. We have hired some additional support, and we're currently doing a literature review on temperature, temperature protocol, and we hope to come back, and then we're going to do analysis of the data. We have at this point 14,000 data points for temperature from our dischargers into a database, and we're conducting the analysis. So we're moving forward. So how do we get there? Again, staff is proposing the general conditional waiver requirements. The requirements address the conditions of Porter Cologne. We're going to use our compliance inspections. We talked about collecting the or analyzing the data over a 24-month period and returning to the board with a report in 30 months. We believe that our process should implement the program and a solution so that we don't end up with continued problems like I showed earlier. We have, as I said earlier, received from the resource professionals a request that we return in 30 months, and staff's not opposed to that. We believe that the general waiver would ensure consistency. We believe it protects water quality and beneficial uses. We believe it allows us more field time. We want to emphasize that we've received a steady stream of comments, and one of the chronic complaints is that we're not out in the field enough, and we believe if we were spending less time writing orders, we could spend more time in the field. And in response to those comments, staff has made a number of changes in the first version you got. We had revised the spreadsheets. We had revised the spreadsheets to include a 303D factor to account for non-timber related cumulative impacts in the watershed. If a water body was listed for sediment or temperature, it received a high cumulative effects ratio impact. We modified the soil disturbance factor by adding the erosion hazard rating for both skid trails and roads in high and extreme areas. We did remove the yarding calculation, the yarding method, because we found it was getting duplicated in whether you're using roads and how many skid trails, because you're capturing that, what type of, whether you're using tractors or cable yarding. And we modified the monitoring program to say that if you're going to take photos, make sure you can see what's in the photo. Don't send us a dark photo. We also revised and we're proposing some additional changes today. We've proposed that there was a concern regarding that the cumulative effects ratio wasn't capturing clearly the reasonably foreseeable projects in the future. So we've modified the language in the cumulative effects ratio to say for acres proposed harvest or harvested in the planning watershed in the last 10 years, include all acreage in proposed and approved THPs and NTMPs. So we make sure they include all the acreage that's out there. In the version that we sent to you, we had called it 303D watersheds, and I want to make sure that that says 303D water bodies, because we designate bodies, not watersheds. Under the monitoring program, there was a comment that it could be interpreted that you don't need to collect the temperature continuously, so staff has added language that says continuous water temperature monitoring is required. Temperature monitoring shall be conducted throughout periods when water is present in Class 1 or Class 2 water course. The resource professionals have sent a letter, which Lori has a copy of, that asked for an exception that there be no water temperature except for with forensic monitoring. It said staff will defer the requirement of any temperature monitoring within a Class 2 water course until such time that staff has reviewed the existing data. Staff is not recommending this change. We did make a change in the monitoring and reporting program that said staff will establish the temperature monitoring stations during the pre-harvest inspection or subsequently thereafter after discussions with the regional board executive officer. And a classic, and why we wanted that flexibility is on the Big Basin plan that you saw back in March, they had four Class 2 drainages draining into the Class 1 Jameson Creek, and we felt it was somewhat redundant to have eight temperature monitoring stations on each upstream, downstream of the Class 2, and we placed a upstream station on the Class 1 and a downstream station on the Class 2, and that's the monitoring program that we approved. For forensic monitoring, we made a clarification that if water is no longer flowing in the Class 2, you don't have to collect temperature data. So if it's just sitting in a little pool, you could take it out. On the visual monitoring, staff added some language that said monitoring shall occur a minimum time of 3 years over each 12 months during year one monitoring. And I know that seems somewhat redundant, but we do have THPs that will begin harvest in year one of their waiver, and for whatever reason, they don't finish up, and they have to stretch it over to a second season. And we wanted them to maintain the more rigorous year one monitoring until harvest was complete. So we added that language to make sure that they do that. They can sometimes not finish a plan based on endangered species constraints or weather conditions. And then finally, in the reporting, staff added a requirement for documentation of rainfall measurement procedures and locations.
Howard, could you go back to that last slide?
Yes, sir.
On the visual monitoring down there.
Yes.
I'm a little confused. It says three times over each 12 months during 1 year. I mean, how many 12 months are there?
Well, it's year one monitoring. So what that means is it, yeah. So if you finish your plan in one summer, you finish your harvesting, then you would only have 12 months in your year one monitoring. But what I was trying to capture is if somebody extends their plan over a second season, the way that some of the monitoring says is, you know, if you, for example, the turbidity monitoring says if you show compliance with your year one monitoring, you don't have to monitor year two turbidity. Well, they're going to go back in and harvest in year two. So I wanted to kick them back into year one monitoring.
Year one should be in quotes.
Yeah.
It has a specific definition.
Yes.
It does.
Over each 12 months of harvest.
Yes. Well, over each 12 months of the first,
in which there is some harvest.
Yes, exactly. Does that make sense?
In other words, every 12 months that they're going in, they have to do year one.
Yeah, so if they go in year one, if they go in the summer of 2005 and they harvest and they don't complete, and they have to go back in the harvest of summer of 2006 to complete their plan, they still have coverage under the waiver, but we're stating that you have to do the same level of monitoring as you would at the beginning. You can't cycle into the... Well, no, that's okay. It says monitoring shall occur a minimum of three times over each 12 months during year one monitoring, and if we need clarification of that
maybe,
in the MRP.
Maybe you need another line saying what a year one is. Because really, if in effect what you're doing is you're saying the definition of year one is, and then...
I think it does actually say that in the monitoring.
Okay.
Year one monitoring.
Yes, the program does have a specific definition for year one monitoring.
For year one.
Yes.
For the term year one.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I think if we just change year one to initial caps in the monitoring and reporting program, it'll clarify it.
Thank you.
And then we also added, as I stated earlier, the information on or the finding on non-concurrence and skid trails. Under non-concurrence, the resource professionals have asked that the non-concurrence, when we talk about resolution, that state resolution during the CDF process. And staff's not opposed to that change, but we haven't made that change yet as of this point. And then with skid trails, as I alluded to earlier, there is some concern that they won't be able to properly manage their timber operations if they're required to map all skid trails in these areas, because sometimes they'll get up there, the LTO will see something that makes it easier to pull a log from a different location. So they've suggested some language. It says, for areas or portions of harvest where tractor operations are proposed and mapping and flagging of skid trails is not required or appropriate, a formula of 100 lineal feet per acre of this area shall be applied. And so that's another change that we could add if this board so desires. Our goal is protection of water quality, beneficial uses. We want to make sure they implement the management practices necessary to do that. And we want to get out there in the field and ensure compliance, because you can write a great order, but if you're not out there supporting it, it won't get implemented. Again, all the individuals I've talked to are supportive of the effort to manage our resources. There is some debate on the best way to do it and what the appropriate level of monitoring are. In conclusion, I ask the board to adopt the negative declaration and adopt the general timber harvest requirements. Any questions?
Dr. Press.
I have a few questions. I'll try to space them out. First of all, I think I want to get at a question of approach and philosophy here. I was happy to see the eligibility criteria for the transparency and accountability that they bring to the process. I want to strongly be on record that we should keep eligibility criteria. In staff replies to comments and questions from interested parties, I noticed in those 50 pages of replies and those many, many, many more pages of comments that there was a staff frequently would make a reply, something to the effect that the eligibility criteria were a tool, an aid for making decisions, but that the field visits, the field sites, field inspections, pre-harvest inspections, etc., were also factored into the staff's decisions about what how the waivers would work. What I would like to make clear, or to get clarity on, is that the eligibility criteria act as a way, in effect, as a backstop. That is to say that if you get a score, if you get scored into a particular tier by the eligibility criteria, am I correct in understanding that is that you won't be downgraded from, say, a tier 2 to a tier 1 based on other factors? You get my drift? It's a matter of a ratchet, in a way, that you only can go into a higher tier with factors other than the eligibility criteria, but you cannot go down into a lower tier. That's my preference, but maybe that's already your assumption.
That is the way we have been using it, because we have chronically requested additional monitoring as opposed to less. But we have, I wouldn't say ratcheted down, but used judgment, for example, on the Big Basin Plan, where the actual requirements of the order would say you have to measure in every class 1. And we looked at that and said, that's not a prudent use of resources and won't gain us a lot of information. So it makes more sense to put the temperature monitoring in the class 1 rather than in the class 2s. So we didn't eliminate any monitoring in the big picture of what's required, but we used field visits and staff professional judgment and discussions with the property owner and the forester to get the appropriate stations and the appropriate information that we need to evaluate what's going on in the plan. And the reason that I just wanted to make sure that those other components weren't overshadowed by the matrix, because one of the large a lot of the comments were the eligibility criteria are not stringent enough, or they're not based in research, or they're not based in data. And I wanted to point out that we use a lot of other things. The eligibility is a tool. We evaluate the plans. We look at it. It sets a somewhat of a backstop. But we do make some professional judgment on where we're placing the monitoring station, so we're not following verbatim what's required in the sense of every class 2 is getting monitoring.
Well, to elaborate a little more, in that situation, we did not eliminate or go from tier 3 to tier 2 and say, instead of doing turbidity monitoring, we're not going to do any turbidity monitoring. We just were more logical about where we did it.
You were in tier 3.
Yes.
With that one. And I guess, again, for there to be transparency and repeatability, the first paragraph of the Tier 3 turbidity requirement, in other words, would be changed. This is where... I'm asking you if that's the case. Discharger shall measure turbidity up and downstream of all newly constructed or reconstructed Class 1 and 2 road crossings. Is this what you're saying staff used some discretion, or it didn't make sense to go to look at the Class 1s, but rather to the Class 2s? I mean, it's page 15 of the order.
If you look down in there, we just put a sentence that sites may be established by the Central Coast Water Board or executive officer during or after a pre-harvest inspection. It is our intent to monitor all sites. However, an example of that, again, is the Big Basin Plan, where we had a culvert being removed and replaced with a bridge, and 50 feet downstream they were taking out a sediment retention facility and a sediment dam. Under the conditions of the order, we would have had to have 4 stations, one upstream of the culvert, downstream of the culvert, one upstream of the check down, and downstream of the check dam. And staff looked at that and said, that doesn't make sense. We'll put one upstream of the culvert and one downstream of the check dam. So, yeah, we did. We used our discretion and best professional judgment. We didn't back off on the requirements. We're still in Tier 3. We're still doing turbidity monitoring, but we made a professional determination that it was more prudent to do it this way, because you're not going to get a big change in turbidity over 50 feet in that channel.
Is there some way that you could have written the monitoring requirements in such a way that would have given you that flexibility or predicted that kind of flexibility, and yet also prevented some backsliding, basically? All I'm saying is...
No, I'm with you.
Trying to make sure that when somebody sees, tier 3, bing, I know what's going to happen.
And that's why it says all newly constructed and reconstructed, because that is our intent. And the only time we'll quote unquote backslide is if it doesn't make sense in the conditions of monitoring. But I don't know how to capture every variable.
I might suggest some language. You could change this to these artifacts shall be measured for turbidity. That doesn't say whether it necessarily is everyone has one up and downstream, but they have to have a measurement of turbidity around them. And you could have two or three or four of them.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And that would measure all of those artifacts. And it would allow you the flexibility to say whether you need one up and downstream of everyone or whether you can combine them like you're talking about. Or you could even say these artifacts have to have turbidity measured for them. E.g., 25 feet up and 25 feet down, if appropriate.
Yeah, that works for me. I'll have to just sort of think exactly how to word that before we get to a recommendation. So.
All right. Okay. I'll just ask a couple more and then I'll let other people talk.
I just want to stress one thing, though. Remember, the same order applies whether you're Tier 3 or Tier 1. So protection of water quality, compliance with the conditions, is not there is no backsliding on that, regardless of whether you're Tier 1, Tier 2, or Tier 3. If you're not protecting water quality, you're in trouble.
Staying with the eligibility criteria, there were some comments throughout that suggested that a longer period of time for the cumulative effects ratio than 10 years might be appropriate. 15 years, well, actually, some people said 13, some people said 17, some people said 15. I'd like to see a 15-year number used. Is there some reason why that wouldn't be practicable, wouldn't be logical? There were some research cited in some of the comments that suggested that that was a better time period for calculating cumulative effects. Why not go to 15 years? What's the objection, if any, to that?
I'm trying to remember what number that was in all my comments so I could give you the answer straight from the text. But essentially, the 10-year proposed number is consistent with what is in the THP NTMP process proposed by the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection. That's the review cycle that they use on all THPs and NTMPs. So that's the information that's available to us when we get the plans. We could request additional information. One of the reasons I didn't feel the need to go on or increase it at this point is if you use a 10-year and you're counting your plan that you're proposing and all the plans that are proposed for that year, you're essentially counting 11 years in that you're counting your plan twice if you went in 10 years ago and now you're going in again. So. And since it's only one factor that we use in determining the level of monitoring, I didn't have a good reason to change it, is my best response. I do feel that we can do additional research, but we haven't done that yet.
All right. Well, I was persuaded that it was a fairly logical and cost-effective way, that is to say, not very costly way of having an even more conservative cumulative effects ratio, which everything we know about cumulative effects is that we don't know much about cumulative effects. And so it's a good idea to be conservative there. And as you say, it's one factor in one index that gets factored into a whole larger index. Anyway. Okay, the last thing I'll say and then yield is about the drainage density index. I raised this at the February meeting, I think. It has two categories, high and low. And
If you're 99.9, you're low. If you're 100, you're at the high, or 100, yeah, you're at the high level. No, 101. The range in the reviewed plans is 0 to 406. The average was 159, with 8 of them below 100. I wonder if it doesn't make a more sensitive index to have 3 categories or maybe even 4 categories. Again, with a fairly conservative tracking, so that you're still tracking, say, medium and high, or maybe you're even tracking the 2, 3, 4 categories into tier 2 and 3, and then the 1 would go into tier 1. But why not have a drainage density index that is whose range more reflects what we see out there? Whenever you have weights and indices, you want to have something that uses the range that's observed in nature, I think.
The values that we establish for drainage density index, I feel, are conservative, and as you point out, most plans end up in a high drainage density index. We did have comments from CDF and others that our drainage density index is unconventional because we weight class 1 and class 2 streams more heavily than class 3 watercourses. Staff believes that protection of water quality is extremely important, and that we wanted to place more emphasis on the presence of water. We could make it more sensitive, but based on our analysis of where we had put plans already under the individual waiver and the level of monitoring, and where plans were falling out as we were doing it through the eligibility criteria, we felt that the two levels of drainage density index was appropriate.
It could be. What I'm suggesting doesn't necessarily make it less conservative. You could have 4 tiers, but it's all shifted down. So you could have a sensitive index that still span the range, but depending on what the triggers are, it could be very conservative. And I guess what I'm saying is that you're more. We have a lot of streams in Santa Cruz Mountains. You're reflecting that topography, that landscape, in a little more nuanced way. So I'd like to hold that open.
Okay.
But I'll yield now and let my colleagues get a crack at it.
Mr. Daniels.
I'm just going to ask a few of my questions, too, and then pass the baton. I'm only going to ask negative deck initial study kind of questions here. You mentioned before that the time frame for this was, I think, January of 2003 in order to capture the individual waiver kind of activities we've been doing.
Yes, sir.
But what we have here is titled Initial Study of Negative Deck for a General Conditional Waiver, which we, in fact, have not even done yet. So which is this? Is this a negative deck for a general waiver, or is it attempting to capture the individual waiver activities we've been doing for the last
years? It's a negative deck for a general waiver, but I was using those activities that we've done in the last year as an example of how it's different from past activities, because a lot of the evidence submitted was based on activities that occurred, or regulatory actions that occurred prior to 2003. So I was just trying to make a distinction of that we are doing things differently.
Okay.
In addition, for CEQA purposes, the baseline is the existing conditions, either at the time the order is adopted or when staff starts the environmental review. And I think that was the beginning of the environmental review.
Okay. Well, I think given that the case, I think we need to recognize that our individual waivers have not been a single uniform process. We've changed and adapted and rearranged the way we think about these and approve these. And as you mentioned, you know, for the last several months, we've been actually kind of using a scheme very much like what's in the general waiver. But before that, we were using much more ad hoc kind of practices, and so to treat that all as one, I think, is probably not appropriate. The next big question is, in doing all these negative decks and EIR kinds of things, you always have to look at the project, what it is. So now we've got that clear. The project is this general waiver. But you also have to look at the no project. You know, what are you comparing it against? And two things immediately come to the possibility of what you might compare it against. You might compare it against completely unrestricted timber harvesting, where the timber harvesters could go out and cut down any tree, anytime, anywhere, any clear cut the whole forest if they want, you know, and compare it against that. You could also compare it against no harvesting going on at all, so no trees in the state of California ever being cut down. There are a number of things in the middle there. I would just like to point out on page, what page is it? There are no page numbers in this. Anyway, I think this is the study. Yes, this is the study. Initial study, and it's a page just after the checklist about the environmental factors potentially affected. There's the first one is item one, aesthetics. And under that, there's a finding about less than significant impact, and it starts off, although unregulated timber harvesting activities could have aesthetic impacts. And I'll just stop right there. And it sounds like what we're comparing this to is completely unregulated timber harvesting. Is that the case?
That is certainly a way that that could be interpreted.
Well, I would take exception to that because I think that is not correct. That even if we don't do any kind of waiver at all, if we completely ignore our responsibility and don't do individual waivers or general waivers or permits or anything, harvesting is still regulated, not by us, but it's still regulated by the THP process. So you never are going to get completely unregulated timber harvesting activities. So to compare it against that is, I think, invalid. Is that, what's your reaction to that?
It wouldn't change my opinion that the proposed project is not going to have an impact or no impact. So I don't believe that the project will have an impact on aesthetics.
Well, okay, but you know, for example, you've got one of them listed as less than significant impact and have a substantial adverse effect on scenic vista. And if you had unregulated timber harvesting, then yes, it could certainly impact scenic vistas. But if you're talking about what does our regulation do over what the THP itself does, I don't see how it would have any impact.
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Okay. If we have imposed this general waiver we've been talking about,
yes,
it's only going to make conditions more strict.
Yes.
It's going to cut down fewer trees.
Yes.
In fact, really what it does is just more monitoring. So it should have zero effect on aesthetics.
Yes.
So this box that you put here, less than significant, is in fact in the wrong column. It should be no impact.
Okay.
And I'd claim that if you probably go through the rest of this, you'll find that indeed the places where you put less than significant impact, indeed there are no impacts. By imposing this general waiver, by adding an additional layer of regulation, it's only going to make things better or less impact than the current conditions. Where I think we'd agree the current conditions is, before January 03, was forestry was regulated just by the THP process.
Yeah, we're just trying to be complete and make sure that we address all the issues. And that's, you know, if you read that third paragraph down at the bottom, it says it's the board's intent that no THP shall be approved which fails to adopt feasible mitigation measures or alternatives, because we don't want any impact.
Well, we can certainly require this, but the point is that it's already required. Yeah, it's state law.
Yeah.
Okay. So I think the point is that this thing is probably more generous than is really the fact that applying these rules are probably going to have zero impact. right down the list. You know, the ones I looked at. Compared to the current situation, which I think we now agree is regulating timber harvesting without water board involvement, just with the THP.
Doesn't that just mean that the initial study is very conservative then?
Hyper-conservative.
Hyper-conservative?
Much more than it should be or needs to be.
Okay.
Any other questions, Mr. Daniels?
Nope, that's it.
Mr. Shallcross?
I only had a couple questions, and I'm actually not even going to ask them now. I don't think they're that important at this late date.
Okay.
At this late time, but I did have one question.
Okay.
that came up since then. You mentioned earlier that this issue about the map skid trails, and you were going to talk about how folks said that they couldn't manage or be difficult to manage, and you were going to elaborate on that?
Yes.
Is that going to be later on? Or?
No, I actually read that language, but I'll read it again.
Okay. Well, no, I know the language. I thought you were going to elaborate on that, that whole argument. Maybe I misunderstood.
I did want to say that staff wants to make sure we capture all the activities that are going on in the soil disturbance factor. And where this came up is we were out on an inspection, and we were walking a ridge line, and it just sort of dawned on me after we had made the walk that there were no map skid trails. And so when they submitted their application to be covered under an individual waiver, I began to say, well, how are we incorporating that particular piece of the puzzle? And I talked to a number of the foresters about how they do that. And some actually mark those areas. Others like to sit with the LTO once the LTO is there and decide where they want to run their equipment. So they had suggested that you have to mark all skid trails. They've suggested language that's similar to other things we have in the soil disturbance factor that says for every 1 acre of land, you assume 100 linear feet of trail per acre. But I didn't make a recommendation whether or not to adopt that. Staff's not opposed to changing that language because our idea is to capture it, and I think that would capture it.
Could you just state it again as language that would go into the EC?
It would say for harvest areas or portions of harvest areas where tractor operations are proposed and the mapping and flagging of skid trails is not required or appropriate, a formula of 100 lineal feet of trail per acre of this area shall be applied.
Applied to the EC?
Yeah, right. The soil disturbance factor.
To the SDF.
Okay, Mr. Jeffries?
I'll pass.
Okay, Dr. Hunter?
I'll just make one brief comment. I was interested in, it's a big subject to tackle, but I was interested in cumulative effects and how that CER ratio played into it, and I see a number of changes that you commented on today in response to some of the comments that were submitted, and I'll be interested to see how monitoring develops in terms of continuing to evaluate cumulative effects. In particular, you know, I think you may have had a chance to see a question that I submitted in writing that concerned how the CER ratio would change relative to additional activities being introduced over, say, a five-year period from initiating a particular THP, and then during that five-year period that the conditional waiver is in place, how other activities coming online upstream, say, and non-timber harvest-related activities, how those things would be evaluated. So I see some information about that, and I see 303D listed water bodies are also going to be taken into account, which I think is another good way to go. So be looking forward to monitoring evaluations coming out of that.
Are we ready to go to public comment? More questions?
Not too many, just a little teeny bit. Could you explain to me the rationale for the weight in the soil disturbance factor for the winter ops? You have a weight of about 20%, 1.2. I calculated that if you had gone to a 2.0, a 2X factor, you would have moved SDF scores, 13 SDF scores that were low into medium, and two that were medium into high. I suppose that what you're saying with that weight is that winter ops, in effect, are 20% more disturbing to soils than summer ops or non-winter ops. Why not 50%? Why not 100%? What's the rationale there? Again, I'm trying to be conservative and transparent.
Staff was trying to capture the winter ops, and that's why we put in that factor. We also have placed a couple conditions into the monitoring program. For example, if you pull out a temporary culvert prior to October 15th, we don't require that you do monitoring on that culvert. So we're trying to factor in a bunch of different ways to have minimal impact in the winter. And keep them out of winter ops. Again, another reason why we're asking for documentation of rain and whatnot. The 20% was a value we felt reflected the increased level of risk. We did not evaluate 50% or doubling it. So.
Okay, we can come back.
Okay.
I agree with this issue myself. As we saw yesterday, you know, there was a case where, you know, they started some operation late in the season, and it was a complete disaster. You know, they spent the whole season trying to fix the problems rather than finish up their project. And if they just started, you know, a month and a half earlier, they could have been done before October 15th. And I agree that, you know, winter issues, I think, can be real serious, and I think we need to take them seriously. In fact, I was thinking of taking winter activities and automatically bumping them up another tier. So that's more extreme than what Dr. Press is talking about, but I think something serious like that needs to be taken. On page 9 of your staff report, item 26, you talk about currently attachment 1 shows tier 2 does not require water quality compliance monitoring. However, at this stage of eligibility criteria development, staff proposes for tier 2 plans to propose monitoring program require water quality compliance monitoring turbidity in all new and reworked class 2 and class 1 and class 2 water course crossings and temperature in class 1 water course, etc. And I don't see that. I look back here in the Tier 2 MRP, and it's not there, nor did I see it in your list of recommended changes. And I agree with this. I think that's a good change.
Yeah, no, staff was proposing that we just do that when we issue. We didn't necessarily want to change the whole order to say that because it's only going to go for 24 months. But we wanted to make sure that we did that for the first 24 months because if the order is approved, it goes for 5 years, and we didn't necessarily want to have that constraint in the order for 5 years. We could put a qualifier in there that says for the next 24 months, all Tier 2 have to do turbidity and temperature monitoring.
I think for clarity, we should have it in the order explicitly rather than just kind of assuming that's going to happen. I would like to ask about a comment. It's on page 42 of the comments section. From Chris Berry of the Santa Cruz Water Department, and he's talking about the existing FDRs allow reduction of total canopy within the Lopez of Class 2 watercourses to 50% of pre-harvest condition and requires that only 25% of the overstory composed of conifers. And then he goes on to mention, this regulation with a 10 to 14-year reentry period will maintain these watercourses in a perpetual state of adolescence and disturbance. And I agree with him. And he's suggesting that we require additional protections to Class 2 streams as a best management practice. And I'm wondering why you don't think that's not a great idea.
It's not necessarily not a great idea, but again, the conditions of the order don't allow impacts to water quality, regardless of what tier you're in. So our position is the conditions of the order will be protective of water quality. And if there are concerns, I would encourage the board to look at the conditions of the order and if we need some additional conditions. But the conditions say you will not cause pollution, you will not change temperature, you will not discharge, is essentially what they say.
Okay. All right, Doug. Let's talk now. Okay. Can we move to public comment then? Okay. So we have 10 speaker cards, and folks, what's that?
45 minutes.
About 45 minutes, and please, we'll take your comments on both agenda items, 25 and 26. You can give them to us at the same time. We'll start with Clay Brandow, followed by Lewis Shippen.
Good evening, Board. My name is Clay Brandow. I work for California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection. There were some new things that came up regarding the negative declaration, and I just wanted to cover those first. The change that Howard suggested on the resolution of non-concurrences is something that we support because there is a process in the Forest Practice Act and also in the Forest Practice rules that governs the resolution of non-concurrences, and so we'd like to use that process and not invent another. On the mapping of skid trails, we support that change too because we'd like to keep the map requirement, mapping requirements for skid trails as it is in the forest practice rules, and we think that this is a good solution to add this accounting method that Howard suggested. And then we're also supportive of the 30-month report because we think there's going to be a lot of data collected under this waiver that may not necessarily be very useful. So we would like a review at that point. CDF is familiar with the past published research and monitoring, and we strongly support an interagency mitigation monitoring team approach that's been discussed at the monitoring study group. In general, the department commends you and your staff for developing an approach and determines monitoring requirements based on increasing risk associated with individual THPs in the Central Coast region. CDF has provided you with recommendations in letters dated March 3rd and March 17th. Our three primary concerns are the eligibility criteria and now as proposed are somewhat arbitrary, and in some cases they're contrary to available science and research. Two, the available eligibility criteria are, as proposed, require an unreasonably large percentage of the plans to go into Tier 2 and Tier 4, 50% by the staff report attachment number 5. And three, the monitoring and reporting program, as currently proposed, would result in plans for individual THPs, particularly under Tier 3, which are not efficient and maybe excessively expensive. And typically, such MRPs plans do not take full advantage of implementation and effectiveness monitoring and forensic monitoring, and may include types of monitoring that produce inconclusive results in regulatory settings as opposed to long-term research settings. And so for this reason, we'd like you to consider our six recommendations that we've made in our May 17th letter. And basically, I'd like to stress that we strongly support the forensic and hill slope monitoring, and we'd like to try to limit the amount of water column monitoring. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay. Mr. Shippen?
Shipper.
Okay,
I'm Lewis Shipper.
R looks like an N.
Sloppy writing.
That's all right.
My name is Lewis Shipper. I am with RMC CEMEX, and some of our data was used and compiled in the report that Mr. Kolb has just given. However, I'm specifically here to try to clear up some misunderstandings and, we believe, incorrect information in an article that was recently published, in which this board meeting was specifically mentioned, concerning turbidity problems in the Davenport water supply, and it was insinuated that these were somehow a result of the timber harvesting that we do in the San Vicente. We are the water supplier to the county of Santa Cruz that operates the Davenport water supply. We have supplied since the early 1900s water free of charge, and to the town of Davenport. In addition to that, we supply 75% of all their capital costs and 50% of all of their operating costs, and I have to say that we receive no water from that system. So we do that strictly as the neighbor. And we have done that now for time out of mind. The statement was is that somehow this was because the Davenport water supply is having a problem, and the problem is that they built a plant 25 years ago, which we of course paid for 75% of, but that's neither here nor there, and it has not been modified in the last 25 years. In addition to that, 10 years ago, there was changes made to the treatment requirements for surface water, and I'm sure this is something that many of the board members are aware of, that disallows chlorination for anything over 5 NTUs. The problem is the treatment facility was put in 25 years ago to meet standards of that time. Those standards have changed. The treatment facility itself is woefully out of date and woefully under capacity. The water that, in addition to state, you know, the idea that we would somehow do timber practices that was causing the county to pay $60,000 a year for hauling water. Well, we pay half of every dollar that they spend. So if the idea is that we were somehow saving so much money by going through improper practices so we could pay $30,000 additional to haul water, I think that's a rather large stretch. I wanted to bring this to your attention because, as I said, it was specifically stated that that this meeting would be important. We believe it to be a completely misleading statement, and we thought we'd better make the record straight. Any questions?
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bohanna Morgenthaler?
Why don't you call the next person? She's not here.
Okay, we'll go on to the next person then. Okay. And we'll follow with Dennis Jackson, then Kevin Collins, and Jody Frediani.
Hello. My name is Bohanna Morgenthaler. I'm a board member of the Sierra Club Santa Cruz Group and Citizens for Responsible Forest Management. I'm here today to encourage the board to make the general condition waivers for the THP truly effective by several modifications. The first one would be to require rigorous staff participation in the timber harvest review process, including the in-progress and post-harvest inspections. Secondly, by adopting meaningful eligibility criteria for determining monitoring tier levels. Dennis Jackson, our expert, has actually submitted extensive information on that, so I won't go into specifics. Also, the third one, by modifying the order adopting the general waiver to require the implementation of additional management practices to ensure that water quality is protected. And fourth, by adopting quality assurance, quality control requirements for all aspects of the MRP. Believe that these four actions would make the general condition waiver more effective in meeting its purpose of protecting the public interest by protecting water quality. I believe that the proposed waiver does not adequately protect drinking water or illicit fish species. For instance, I would like to cite that San Vicente Creek in Santa Cruz provides the sole drinking water supply for the town of Davenport, and it also supports coho and steelhead runs, fish on the verge of extinction. The watershed above intakes is largely in timber production. There are currently about 1,000 acres of active THPs in the upper watershed. To date, only one CDF summer inspection has been conducted, and no inspections have been done by the Water Board staff of the active harvests. These plans have major minor amendments, including adding 2,000 feet of new road, adding landings, widening the road for 130 feet, removing redwoods, and making an 8-foot cut in an area adjacent to a stream crossing. This past spring, Davenport sent out a do not drink boil order to its citizens because the treatment plant could not handle the sediment load. I would really like to ask the board to seriously consider and implement, again, the more rigorous staff participation through all phases of the timber harvest review, to adopt additional best management practices for enrollment in the waiver, to adopt more meaningful eligibility criteria to determine the appropriate monitoring tiers, and finally, to adopt the quality assurance, quality control requirements for all aspects of the monitoring and reporting program. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Any questions, Mr. Daniels?
What do you mean by additional BMPs and management, and what do you mean by the QAQC? You have specific things you're proposing, or just?
Well, I think there were some specific things that had been submitted in the recommendations, both from the Lompico Watershed, CRFM, Sierra Club, and Ocean Conservancy. I'd like to refer to those submissions that were provided.
Okay, I don't remember those. So. Okay.
Okay. Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your attention.
Okay. Dennis Jackson. And you've got 10 minutes, Mr. Jackson.
Thank you.
Okay.
So I'm a hydrologist representing CRFM and Lompico Watershed Conservancy and the Santa Cruz group of the Sierra Club. And I've submitted five letters since February dealing with this process. And I find that there's still several technical problems with the process. I think the underlying problem I feel is that the tacit assumption by staff, or actually it's not even tacit, it's right out there, that the forest practice rules are sufficient by themselves to protect water quality, and I disagree with that. They've not been certified by the U.S. EPA. CDF apparently in recent times has been approving major minor amendments to THPs after they've been approved and have had the regional board staff review, and so these additional amendments to these THPs haven't received board staff review for their effects on water quality. I find that kind of undercutting the whole idea of the general waiver. The order or the general waiver doesn't strictly require staff to attend all PHIs. It's still an option based on their workload. And in the past, staff hasn't been able to attend any inspections after harvest has begun or a post-harvest inspection. I feel these inspections are very important to see how everything worked out, to see whether the BMPs actually worked. And again, other boards like the North Coast Board and the Central Valley Board have required specific additional best management practices for enrollment in the waivers. And their orders are online, and you can see the specific types of practices that they're recommending. So next slide, please. Oh, and also forgot that in the beginning of the monitoring and reporting program supplemental sheet that was just put out, there is an added statement just at the beginning of this month that essentially the executive officer has complete discretion over what monitoring will be done. I think it's fine that staff has flexibility, but by giving what at least the language, the way I read it, complete unbridled discretion without statements of findings and supporting evidence for their particular take on the level of monitoring required kind of flies in the face of a transparent and open process. So then you can go to the next slide. And one of the things that seems to have changed from February is that in February the eligibility criteria were purported to be the central tool in developing what monitoring level was going to be applied. And now it is receded into the background and is only one of many tools. And there's nothing wrong with using multiple approaches to do that. But, the more this mechanical process is downplayed, I think the less transparent the decision process becomes. And then there is flaws, I think serious technical flaws, with the eligibility criteria, but they could be corrected. And starting with is that the eligibility criteria themselves are not part of the order. They're just part of the staff report and not the same legal weight as the monitoring and reporting program and the general order itself. The eligibility criteria use this CER, the DDI, and the SDF, and each of these has significant problems. And like I said before, the staff's professional judgment's replacing the eligibility criteria and a decision tool. I've offered a reworking, keeping the form of staff's eligibility criteria intact and replacing all the parts that I thought had trouble and coming up with my own eligibility criteria that are based not on weighting factors arbitrarily or by just simple feeling of what's the right value, but by referencing values in the literature. And I won't go into all the details I've put into that right now. So you can go to the next slide. Actually, I've just covered that, so you can go to the next slide. The cumulative effects ratio, as staff has it now, there's a 10-year time horizon. I believe that should be a 15-year time horizon. I believe that because landslide activities tend to peak in the ballpark of around 15 years after a harvest is completed, so it would more effectively capture the disturbance actually caused by a harvest or potentially caused by a harvest.
Do you have any evidence for that?
I have cited studies in my letters. I don't have those right here with me, but they're in my letters, and staff has those, and you've had been given copies in the past. And many THPs in the Santa Cruz Mountain region have 14-year return periods. So if you only have a 10-year time, you're not even counting the last re-entry in it. And so I think that it should be extended to 15 years. Next slide. The drainage density index uses this non-standard method where the class 1s are weighted more heavily than class 2s less heavily and 3s not weighted really at all. All the experts have commented, CDF and others, have all noted that the staff's creation of this DDI is upside down, that the in the winter flow is happening in the class 3s, They're playing a very important role in the hydrology and sediment transport of the channel network, and they should not be downgraded just because there's fish present in class ones. All the sediment that's entering class threes is going downstream towards those fish. And the staff is also saying that their DDI captures the drainage effects on water, but it's really the standard drainage density index that's capturing this, and it's the standard drainage density index that's expressing the effects of climate, geology, soils, vegetation. And then staff has used a handful of THPs to calibrate their DDI breakpoint at 100, and they haven't taken a set of brand new THPs from other places than the ones they've been looking at and see how well it works out. In water quality monitoring or water monitoring hydrology, we would call that validating the calibration set. It's a very important step. If you don't do that, then you can only assume that your model fits only the data you've calibrated to, and you cannot extrapolate that to new situations. Howard, next slide. The soil disturbance factor, it adds several different measures, all with different dimensions, to create one single number for the final soil disturbance factor. This is really bad practice. When you mix dimensions like this, you lead to unexpected results. And just to finish up, I think that the fundamentally, to myself, the fundamental problem with this is that the monitoring and reporting program does not have any quality assurance, quality control. That means that you send out four different foresters, you'll get four different completely uncomparable sets of data. They won't necessarily write down the exact time. They won't collect the samples the same way. They won't handle the samples the same way. They won't calibrate the instruments the same way. They won't report it on a standard form the same way.
Mr. Jackson, could you wrap it up?
Yeah. So without a, you know.
Okay, you'd like a quality control plan.
Quality control plan. I mean, they're required for any kind of monitoring.
Okay, so. Thank you very much.
I have one question.
Yes.
The BMPs you mentioned on this website, that really is interesting, but if we're to adopt this tonight, that doesn't do me any good. So what are some of these BMPs you'd like to see?
Well, on the North Coast, for slides, they specify that you can't cut down more than a certain percentage of trees on the toe of the slide. Mm-hmm. There's more about winter operations. You have to be... Have a greater deal of planning to have winter operations. And I'm sorry, I just can't really right now bring them the rest of them to mind.
Okay. For staff, I have a question. I've been concerned as well, and I've heard about the amendments, the ability to change the THP after the fact, and you know that could seriously change what it, like. I've heard you can even add winter operations after the fact. And do we have any provision in our thing to require this to be reevaluated when those kind of things happen?
We don't have any provisions, but the conditions of the order do not allow impacts to water quality or beneficial uses, regardless of a minor or major amendment. The conditions of the order will not change if they choose to change. I think what people are struggling with is that they may need more monitoring.
Yeah,
and we can make a, if you're going to apply for minor amendments, you have to flood it, we can make a condition that we have to change the monitoring from tier 2 to tier 3. I mean, we could just make that a finding. Okay. If you do it a minor amendment or this type of amendment, you're kicked up a notch to sort of capture that. Because I will agree with Mr. Jackson, that is a concern. I have seen amendments that come through, and I'm like, wait a minute, and I call the guys and find out what's going on. So we do keep track of those.
Okay, I would support that. What about the issue about the eligibility not being part of the order, and what legal basis do the eligibility criteria have? We have an order, we have a MRP, and what is the status of these criteria we've been discussing?
I'm going to defer to Lori if she'll address that.
But it's not true.
Fine if it's not. I hope it's
in
not.
It's in the revised order. I look for it, too.
It is in the MRP. Find the revised order. It's in the revised order in paragraph 4, which specifies when the executive officer is not to approve an NOI or to terminate coverage of someone who's already enrolled in the waiver. So the new condition C says that the EO shall not approve enrollment or shall terminate enrollment if the THP is likely to adversely affect the quality or beneficial uses of waters of the state, and the eligibility criteria is one of the things that the EO is to look at. He is also to look at the THP or NTMP, the pre-harvest inspection information, other site inspections, and any monitoring information available that's specific to this site.
Right. And the final question I have is the DDI weightings. I have indeed seen other commenters talk about the fact that they don't like the weightings that have been picked here. Maybe you could comment on that.
Yeah, I can't debate that nobody's liked what we've created. Again, our interest was protection of water quality, and we felt that Class 1, Class 2s are where we're more apt to find the beneficial uses that you find in the basin plan. You don't necessarily find aquatic organisms in a Class 3. That doesn't preclude the sediment transport issue that he was talking about. But by adopting the normal or the current version of the DDI that's in the literature, would essentially take away all our weightings and would essentially just lower all our drainage density index values, and then we'd go back and recalibrate and find out what the appropriate number was without the weighting, whether it was 75 or 50. So, and we can do that, and that maybe blends back to your question earlier, Dr. Press, about should we have a more sensitive drainage density index.
Okay, Mr. Collins.
Oh,
go ahead.
I just wanted to quickly, I agree with Mr. Daniels on the minor amendment issue. I think we really, because they call them minor amendments for CDF purposes, but sometimes if you look at them for water quality issues, these are major changes. And I don't know how you're going to do it, but maybe, have a reevaluation when minor amendments come through of the tier level or... I'm sure there's some way you can fashion it, but for our purposes, the term minor amendment, I don't think we should get hung up on the minor part.
One thing I think we got to keep in mind, though, is sometimes those minor amendments are like changes in the LTO or something like that, and so maybe we can have some kind of water quality qualifier.
Is your radio on there? Is your mic on?
This is that dead one.
Sorry. I think we got to keep in mind that sometimes those minor amendments are changes in the licensed timber operator, for instance. Okay. And so, yeah, if we got to have some kind of water quality qualifier or something like that.
All I'm saying is when minor amendments are made, we need to have the ability.
I totally agree.
To reevaluate. That doesn't mean that we have to reevaluate every time there's a minor amendment. I mean, and that's something that staff is going to have to look at and say, yes, this is changing.
Well, again, on the order items, page 7, item 4, it says the timber harvest activity is likely to adversely affect the quality of waters of state in making this determination. And then later we say we can rescind the waiver at any time. We can terminate it. So we should follow up on that. And yeah. I think we have the conditions already in the order to make that, but we just need to make sure we do it.
We are notified when the amendment is.
We're notified on. We're always notified on amendments.
But maybe we don't have to go to the extreme of terminating. Maybe all we have to do is reevaluate and make some, changes.
I
maybe,
just
maybe
Well, no, because the executive officer can change the monitoring requirements at any time, either for that specific plan or for all plans. So if it's just a matter of monitoring, then that change is just made. If it's a matter of terminating the waiver because the minor amendment is so significant, then the waiver allows for that. But I had a question on who notifies us and what requires them to notify us, because we may want to make it explicit that the discharger has to notify us.
Let's make it explicit, because we get usually notified after the fact, after CDF has approved it.
Well, we could add a condition saying the discharger has to submit that to us simultaneously with submitting it to CDF.
And then for clarity, we should probably put a sentence in that says, upon an amendment, staff has the right to review the monitoring program.
I wouldn't put that in, because that actually acts more as a limiting factor, because they already have that authority.
All right.
Okay, Mr. Collins, you have a combined 8 minutes for both the items.
Good evening.
Mr. Berlage, they had asked in advance for some additional time, so that's why that's happening. Okay.
We objected in our letter of May 18th to the negative declaration, not because we thought that the regional board's involvement in regulating water quality was a new risk to water quality, but because of its importance. I mean, the legislature terminated the previous statewide categorical waiver because CDF's handling of THPs was not protecting water quality, and that's why this started 2.5 years ago. So, you know, according to the Public Resources Code, a negative declaration can only be made if there is no substantial evidence in light of the whole record before the lead agency that a significant impact to the environment may occur. And obviously, it's our opinion, my opinion, that this issue is quite important. To place it under a negative declaration just doesn't seem legal to me. Now, I won't belabor that, because it's a clear enough statement in itself, and I'll go on to some of the other things I wanted to bring up. In response to our letter, the staff wrote this at the beginning. The commenter assumes that dischargers will routinely violate the conditions and that the water board will not enforce the conditions. Now, that is not at all the case. We expect that the dischargers, that being the timber harvest plant submitters, the RPFs, the people are all over the map. There are going to be people who have a history of violation. There are going to be those that are very conscientious and handle these plans. I've been attending the Board of Forestry meetings since 1996. I've seen all kinds of stuff come before them. I've seen amazing violations of the Forest Practices Act, and I've also seen very good and conscientious work by the timber industry. So I strenuously object to this presumption. Now, one of the things that I have to say, I'm somewhat astonished by this idea that because the forest practice rules say that there shall be no effect on the environment, that it's the fact that there is no effect on water quality or wildlife or soil productivity. I mean, every THP ever written says there is no substantial effect on the environment. So for the water quality staff to say that because the rules say this, that then that covers it is it's absurd, really. The real question, and Dr. Herbert made this very clear in her comments in writing, was that the real issue is the extent to which the logging operation is going to increase sediment discharge. If the increase in sediment discharge is within a controllable range that is acceptable and not deleterious to the beneficial uses of water, then things are being handled properly. And if it goes beyond a certain standard, then it's a problem and requires enforcement by the regional board. And that's where the monitoring and reporting is so important. And the lack of quality control, quality assurance, is very evident in the monitoring reports that Jody Frediani and I were able to see. We came down to the board offices here a couple weeks ago, and we asked to see the files, to see some of the reporting that had come in from the different THPs. And I, for one, looked at the turbidity monitoring. And each forester had their own way of preparing the information. And in no case did any of them state a very... There are certain very basic pieces of information that could have been included. For instance, how many hours after the end of substantial rainfall was this sample taken? Now, that simple piece of information would make the turbidity information dramatically more useful, because there's a huge... As Brian Dietrich, Dr. Dietrich, who came, I think... couple months ago doing the Cal Poly study, he showed graphs of stream response to rainfall, and turbidity spikes and it goes up and down, and there's a very rapid curve. And the difference between 2 hours after a storm and 24 hours after the storm in the number of NTUs you're going to get in a reading is huge. It's orders of magnitude. It may be a hundredfold or more in change, especially in the smaller order streams like the class 2s and so on. And that brings me to this issue of what could be done with this waiver program. For instance, the North Coast Board has made their waiver conditional upon the implementation of better management practices. For instance, in this case, Member Daniels brought up the logging practice around class 2s. The board could make the waiver available to those submitting a timber harvest plan conditional upon better forest retention around class 2 watersheds, perhaps, and class 3s. The National Marine Fisheries Service pointed out very effectively that the class 3 watercourses are often the major sources of sediment. When it's raining hard, a lot of the head cutting and the erosion takes place in the class 3s. They're the steepest watercourses, and that soil and sediment goes directly into the class 1 very quickly. So, in other words, what I'm getting at is that this waiver could be made conditional upon the adoption of more protective practices, and that WDR could be used for those who chose to simply use the forest practice rules. And I think that would be a substantial improvement. I hope that that we will see some specifications for reporting when it comes to matters like turbidity. You have some requirements for or standardization of photo point monitoring. Well, certainly turbidity monitoring needs some similar quality control, quality assurance guidelines, because it's the most expensive and hopefully the most useful and important kind of monitoring that the board is requiring. Thank you.
Questions? Mr. Daniels?
I have a question of staff. Are these, I particularly found the you know, recording the time of the rainfall relative to the reading pretty compelling, and I'm wondering, have you looked at the other QAQC things they're thinking about? Because I agree that it's going to be an expensive kind of monitoring, and we indeed want it to be as effective as we can. So, you know, simply things like, you know, when does this occur relative to the rainfall, I think that's would be pretty good to capture.
Staff has been looking at the data submissions. We've been putting them into the CCAMP database, and our plan is to develop a data sheet that we give to the foresters. We're just not quite there yet. The plan would be to have them submit the data on this electronic format so that we could port it straight into the database, and it would be available shortly after we got the reports to the public, because one of our concerns is, and one of the concerns we've heard is, there's not public access to the information readily. Mm-hmm. So we have considered those issues. We just aren't quite there yet.
And you're thinking about capturing this kind of information, or?
Yeah. Yeah, we already asked that they record, submit in the annual reports how they're recording rainfall information. So, yeah, we're not opposed to that at all.
Okay. Good, because I support that.
Okay. Jody Fradiana, you also have 8 minutes for the two items.
Can I add one thing to what Howard said on the monitoring?
I believe I asked for additional minutes on item 26, and so I was granted 6 minutes for that, and I assumed I'd have 3 minutes on item 25.
Do you need 9 minutes?
Pardon me?
Do you need 3 minutes on the other one?
I do. I'm afraid I do. If I end up short of that time, I'd be happy to leave the podium.
All right.
So, Jody, do you want the neg deck presentation first?
Yeah. Could I amplify on what Howard was just saying while they're getting squared away there? Should I make this 9 minutes? Talking about using... excuse me just a second.
I'm sorry.
Talking about using this CCAMP methods for incorporating this data with the other action that the board took on a significant waiver program or regulatory program for ag. We've already been able to come up with this web-based system for acquiring data, and not only does it enable the acquisition of data electronically, but it's set up such that it's kind of like if you try to buy something with a credit card, and if you don't put in your credit card number properly, it kicks it back. And so it has quality assurance built into it, so that if the data is not submitted correctly or it's incomplete, then it kicks it back and it doesn't accept it, and it goes right back to them and says, fill this out. And we even have red boxes to say where it's inadequate. So we've got that working with the ag data, and I don't see any reason why we couldn't use that for timber as well.
We're next in line. So.
Okay, go ahead.
Ready? Okay. Greetings, Jody Frediani, for CRFM and Sierra Club. Next, please. Just like to start by saying we believe the initial study is seriously flawed. It assumes that the forest practice rules are sufficient to protect water quality. There's language in there that says that the Water Board has direct authority, responsibility, staffing resources, and expertise to make sure that everything is implemented, enforced, and evaluated, which we haven't seen actually happen yet. References that other agency approval is often needed for timber harvest plans, and talks about Santa Cruz timber harvest permits and Monterey protected tree removal. Both of these have been superseded by the forest practice rules. And under the environmental factors, where it talks about relying on the mapping of skid trails, we actually call that a paper BMP. But it says that that CDF can add or modify management practices based on this. And it's our feeling that since they're not required by CDF, that CDF will say they're not required to be, you know, part of the timber harvest review. Next, please. Forest practice rules do not protect water quality. As you've heard, they have not been certified as best management practices by the US EPA. And there's a whole list of reports there which we submitted, a variety from the Senate Office of Research, Little Hoover Commission, Lippy and Bailey, Declaration from NIMS, the Dunn Report, LSA Report, which was commissioned by CDF itself, Scientific Review Panel, all of which showed that the forest practice rules do not protect the environment. And staff said, well, those don't pertain to the Santa Cruz region, which we disagree, but then there's a Santa Cruz County Justification Packet, which was purely about the Santa Cruz region, and even CDF's Hill Slope Monitoring Study, which included study sites in the Central Coast, showed that 50% of watercourse crossings have problems. Next, please. This is a quote from the supplemental sheet that says CDF has consistently ensured compliance with the forest practice rules in this region. We've shown you many of these slides before. They just don't bear out that statement. Next, please. A negative declaration can only be made if there's no substantial evidence in light of the whole record before the lead agency that a significant impact to the environment may occur. Next, please. These references and the documents that we submitted support a fair argument that significant impacts not only may occur, but that they have been occurring, and their accumulating negative effects on water quality will continue to mount unless your board begins to execute an effective regulatory program. And the order implementing the general conditional waiver, the MRP, and the eligibility criteria are inadequate to protect water quality in their present form. and you've already heard some of our comments about how that ought to be changed, and we'll do that next presentation, please. It's going to take a moment for him to load this. And you can actually go to the second slide. Staff has tried to assert both that logging does not cause sediment discharges and that such problems are all in the past. These are just a few of a multitude of THP-created water quality problems within the last 10 years. These are all activities permitted by CDF. No violations were issued by either CDF or the Water Board. Serious sediment discharge into the waters of the state occurred. Some are continuing to discharge. All involved roads near or adjacent to streams. At least one was created by a major minor amendment approved by CDF without geologic review or review from agencies mandated to protect water quality or any opportunity for public input, and that's the one on the right that your staff showed you earlier. Next, please. These are the current THPs with waivers, and as Kevin Collins stated, we did some review from the Water Board list. Five, and when we talk about inspections here, we're talking about during or post-harvest, not the PHIs. So five of those 21 plans had no CDF inspections, 15 no winter inspections, 20 no Water Board inspections, 19 no CGS inspections, and 13 of the 21 have, quote, major minor amendments which have been approved by CDF after the issuance of a waiver. Several of the CDF inspections were done prior to the winter period and found that not all the mitigations were in place. However, no follow-up field visits were conducted. The 21st plan was issued a violation by CDF, which precipitated a field visit by Water Board staff and a Water Board violation, which had no required fix-it date. And there have been, at least at the time we did this in June, no follow-up inspections. The two plans that CGS inspected had potential water quality problems. Next, please. Next. Okay. And these minor amendments or major amendments are specifically defined as substantial deviations on the forest practice rules and as such are to be processed as major amendments with full THP review, but they were deemed by CDF staff to be minor and therefore did not undergo that agency review. These amendments include activities evaluated and ranked under the eligibility criteria, such which may be high risk to water quality. And in most cases, follow-up site inspections have not been conducted. And they include, as you can see, winter ops, where the deadline was extended from a 4-inch to a 6-inch cutoff, extended with no cutoff for date or rainfall amounts, in-lieu road widening in the Wilpez, 8-foot cut, 130 feet of widening, new landings, new Class 3, 2,700 feet of haul roads, cable yarding, switch to tractor yarding on a plan that already had erosion control violations, and landings and roads outside the plan boundary. Okay, now next. Thank you. Items of concern, that 13 of these have major minor amendments. Well, we've already talked about the problems there. Annual reports on many of the plans were submitted at least 6 months after the due date. At the time, we did not see any staff analysis of any of the submitted monitoring data, no follow-up site inspections. There was one inspection conducted for the THP with violation, and the Water Board violation notice sets no deadline for the correction and no follow-up inspection. So the fact that there are no problems from the plan since 2003, we feel is unsubstantiated and unverified. Next, please. Problems with the general timber waiver process. I think you saw some of this earlier. The executive officer is granted total discretion for the MRP, loss of transparency, efficiency, and certainty, and we agree with Dr. Press that setting the eligibility criteria as a backstop is absolutely appropriate. What staff was talking about was flexibility in the monitoring reporting program, which we also feel is appropriate. Staff is not required to attend PHIs or participate in the review process. The Central Valley waiver requires staff and has more a stronger eligibility criteria when staff are not involved. Major minor amendments approved afterwards. Eligibility criteria monitoring you heard was flawed, and we're hearing that the waiver requirements are being limited to the basin plan, and we believe that more rigorous requirements can be implemented. Next, please. Recommended changes that we would like to see require to in the order itself require staff participation in the THP PHI process. That's part of the Central Valley waiver, not of ours. Require that staff proposed harvest mitigations be incorporated in the timber harvest plans. They can do that during the PHI. Develop additional best management practices as conditions of the waiver, and require fees, which will be imposed once the State Board establishes a fee. All of those are now part of the Central Valley waiver. Additionally, we'd like to see staff be required to review and approve all major minor amendments. We want to see reestablishment of the transparency, certainty, and simplicity in the process. A backdrop would do it. We'd like to see a two-year sunset clause and adopt, which is not on there, quality assurance, quality control for all aspects of the monitoring and reporting program. That's it.
Okay.
If I did it under time,
you did.
I apologize for talking so fast.
10 seconds to go. Okay, any questions?
in your documents in here, you were talking about the cumulative factors. Maybe you could explain to me what you're thinking about the cumulative effects and...
In what documents? I'm sorry?
Some of the things you'd submitted. You talked about cumulative effects and your concern about the cumulative effects.
Well, a whole series of documents have come out over the last number of years showing that the forest practice rules do not actually protect water quality. And when it comes to cumulative effects, the forest practice rules work on a project-by-project basis and say, well, this one's not going to cause any impact, therefore there's no cumulative effect. And that's not the way cumulative effects are determined. They're determined by a little bit here, a little bit here, maybe a lot here, a little bit here, and when you put that together, that's a cumulative effect. So even in this process of individual waivers, you're not addressing the issue of cumulative impacts, and it's one of the reasons for actually going with WDRs, which we have not been pushing down here, but which they're doing up in the North Coast.
Oh,
is there more that you wanted to know?
That's a change. I have to ask the question. In one side, you're more than encouraging, you're demanding staff participation in all these things, and yet you're also asking us to do a full EIR, which again, that pulls staff resources away to do that, and that it's a conflict to me. It sounds like you want your cake and eat it too. And
well, I'm going to say something that's a little bit tricky here. I didn't actually ask that you do a full EIR. I'm saying that I don't believe with the information in the initial study that a negative declaration is actually appropriate and that an EIR should be done. But if, in fact, and I believe that Sarah Newkirk has said this to you in the past, that if, in fact, we felt comfortable with the general waiver and the monitoring reporting program with some of the recommendations that you've heard from other people here, that we might not feel obliged to press the issue of an EIR, because then you would have a monitoring program that hopefully would be able to actually do what it's supposed to do.
Okay.
And so, we do understand that every time this goes back, it's harder for staff. At the same time, we hear that there's only 0.6 PY actually doing this stuff, and yet, there's another staff person who is going out and doing the PHI inspection. So there's a little bit more, and, we would like to see staff participate in this. We were told, I thought, some time ago that staff did have time and would be doing inspections in the last winter. Mm-hmm. So, it is a problem, but I think if we don't get it right now, we're going to have a lot of problems down the road.
I don't think there's probably disagreement with that up here. And that's one of the reasons to do this general waiver, is to allow them to have less time doing paperwork and more time in the field to find problems.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is the time to get it right, and part of why we asked for a two-year sunset is, we hear that staff is still researching water temperature, and there are some other items, and, when I've talked with staff directly, well, we're looking at this. We're still trying to fine-tune this, and I think that rather than have this go out for 5 years, that to get it, get something with some more meat in it now, and bring it back in 2 years after having reviewed some of the data, found out what the problems are, seeing whether it's effective, you know, might say, it's going great, let's extend it for another 5, or here are some things that we need to change now, mm-hmm. instead of waiting until 5 years down the road when we have problems.
Well, particularly since we're doing this 24-month, 30-month cycle, I find that compelling as well, that we should probably look at this system at that time and possibly revisit things. So I don't disagree. I also, by the way, don't disagree with your statement that THPs aren't always perfect, that they don't guarantee to protect the environment. In fact, that one little sentence you had on one of your slides, if that's in our document, I think we just take it out, because I don't think that's necessarily accurate. And, I think, indeed, one of the reasons we're doing this is because we don't necessarily believe that THPs will always protect the environment. We think we have to monitor to make sure that that's okay. doing the right thing.
Can I just add one more to your question about the cumulative effects? Okay. What I believe there is, staff has talked about adding this future project of all the acreage in the NTMPs, and the way the language is in the forest practice rules is they are supposed to disclose past, present, and reasonably probable foreseeable future projects. So if, in fact, there's another project in the watershed that is in preparation, and the person submitting this plan here is either preparing that or knows it's being prepared, that acreage is supposed to be included in that. And I believe that the 10-year, and it says not to be limited to 10 years in the forest practice rules for that review, but I believe that figure was because 10 years is the usual reentry period. But in the Santa Cruz region, that has been changed. So depending on how much you cut, you can re-enter in 10 years or in 14 years. Mm-hmm. So.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? All right. Mr. Berlage, followed by David Van Lennep, Nadia Hamey, and Matt Diaz. Those are our last four speakers.
Chairman Young, members of the board, my name is Bob Berlage. I'm here representing Big Creek Lumber Company and our 250 full-time employees. Before I start, I would like to request that all written comments and public comments made by representatives of my company and people, forest landowners and people from the general forestry community that have been made in the past regarding this issue and general waivers be incorporated into the public record for this item.
Yeah, I think the record of this item includes all the workshops we've had. There have been a variety of hearings on individual timber waivers that wouldn't be part of the record, but the workshops would be.
Okay. We've been at this 2.5 years. Last year was the first year in a long time that my company had to cut our sawmill workers off and had a short season, and the primary reason is that we couldn't get waivers of waste discharge. We need to have a fair, reasonable process, and one that doesn't continually ratchet up, one that doesn't end in 2 years, one that doesn't have never-ending requests for more and more and more, getting to the point where it's not affordable for our clients, the small forest landowners, without whom Big Creek can't exist. I don't have 8 minutes or 10 minutes. I could address many of the things if I had the time to do it. Most of that stuff from the anti-logging representatives is old. We've heard it before. Let me just say this. Almost 40 years ago, selective harvesting was adopted within your jurisdiction as the only forest management plan that was allowed. During that time, there hasn't been a single peer-reviewed scientific document that associates what we do in a legally conducted harvest with any kind of environmental harm, including harm to water quality. That's innuendo. That's stuff from up north, studies that don't necessarily have relevance to the kind of timber harvesting that we do. Mr. Jackson, to my knowledge, did not conduct any empirical research down here. In fact, the only data you're getting is from us, It's the forest landowners, and we're going to do that for you. We believe that's going to show you everything we've been saying all along. But there is a point in this process where it's just too expensive. I'm not going to pull punches. These people are here, in my opinion, criticizing this process primarily because they want to see us out of business. Where were they criticizing what we do before they had the ability to have you ratchet up monitoring on us? Where were the complaints about water quality? I don't think they were here complaining to you about that. I don't want to miss the one little change that I had, and this is on page 6 of your report, and it has to do with the, it's actually in the report twice. I'm just going to mention it once and ask that you make this change. It's very small, but it's an important change. If you're interested, I can explain why, but it's number C on page 6 of the general order. It's probably also in the negative declaration, and it's section E. It says a resource agency, and then it lists them. Has filed a water quality related non-concurrence with CDF regarding the proposed harvest. The non-concurrence must be resolved before the waiver takes effect. I would simply ask that be clarified by saying the non-concurrence must be resolved by CDF before the waiver takes effect, because it is their process. The non-concurrence process is statutorily administrated by CDF, so I'd ask that you make that change. My time's up. I'd answer any questions you might have.
Do we understand that change, Laura?
So it's just adding two words. After resolved, it would say resolved by CDF.
I think the reason that staff put this in is that CDF can resolve non-concurrences by just not agreeing with them. And staff felt that this would be more protective because the concerns would actually have to be addressed rather than disregarded. But I think Howard can address that better than
sure.
I can.
Can I respond to that? Because sure. There's an underlying concern.
Yeah.
The County of Santa Cruz, this is just one example, had a Board of Supervisors meeting where they agreed to challenge a timber harvest plan before there was even an approved plan. Our concern about this language is that for reasons that may very well be political, and I guarantee you, challenging a timber harvest plan before you've even seen the project isn't a scientific argument, that's a political argument. If you leave this the way it is right now, who's resolving it? It may not be CDF. The language, the way it's written right now, could be interpreted that another agency needs to have it resolved, and if they don't get a favorable ruling from CDF, we're strung out without being able to move forward with a waiver process, but we have no due process in your action here, because that non-concurrence action is an action from another agency, not from this board or from staff. I just want to, and yes, you're right, there are frivolous reasons to file non-concurrences. We've seen that in the past. What we don't want is for that action to hold up the movement of this waiver process, because the waiver process is between us, the applicant, and your board and your staff, not between us and some other agency that files a non-concurrence. We can't get an approved plan until CDF addresses the issue. That's their statutory responsibility. What I'm trying to do with this language is prevent someone, some other agency, for whatever reason, from filing a non-concurrence and then simply tacking on a water quality concern that automatically carte blanche stops this process. It is CDF's process, the non-concurrence thing. I'm just simply asking that they resolve it as the lead agency, and we clarify what resolve means.
Mr. Shallcross?
Yeah. I think this is a point well taken. at least something that we really need to look at. What are you concerned about? What is staff concerned about in a situation where something that we're really concerned about also, another agency files a non-concurrence and CDF just blows it off and says, you know, that's fine, we don't care, and resolves it that way. How does that restrict what we can do if we agree with the non-concurrence and we feel that it's what they're non-concurring in is detrimental or threatening to water quality?
It doesn't limit what we can do, but what I was trying to do with that was put more control at the local level for the other resources agencies so that CDF did pay a lot of attention to their concerns. Now, it could be we could also resolve it by saying that is resolved by CDF and the executive officer. So CDF could go through their process, resolve it, submit a plan to us, and we would just have to make a note of it somehow when we issue our waiver, or we change a monitoring requirement or a condition or decide that it's not appropriate. I just don't want it to go by the wayside, but I really do understand the Bob's concern, because I don't want frivolous water quality concerns to stymie the process either. So it is a sensitive issue.
I have a question. We have the ability to non-concur too, right?
Yes, we do.
Are there timing restrictions so that if we hear that a local agency is non-concurring and we agree with that, can't we just also non-concur? And so we could limit this condition to non-concurrences by us?
Well, except there's a time restriction on CDF, and if you don't non-concur by the time, then you don't get to non-concur.
So if we
speak.
Find out about it on the last day, it's too
well,
late.
Where it really came up is Lands Bountiful, which is a plan that we were looking at about 3 years ago, and Bill Arkfeld of our staff sent a letter to CDF requesting monitoring being included, and he was non-concurring with the plan, and their response to him was, we got your letter 2 days after the non-concurrence. And I was like, well, you should still respond to it because we're the Regional Water Quality Control Board, and they just elected to blow it off. So I want to make sure if there is a non-concurrence at any level, it's addressed. And that was my reason for putting that in there.
Well, that seems, though, that it was a concern that we had about water quality, and we just blew the deadline, which we
hadn't
done.
But also, it does happen that there are other non-concurrences where the local resources agency has concerns about water quality. For example, one of the plans you approved today, Cowell, there was a concern by the county and Fish and Game regarding the time of entry during wet weather and how they were going to calculate that. And there was a miscommunication in the field, because that issue was not discussed during any of the PHIs that staff attended, and we did attend 3 PHIs on that. And then subsequently a non-concurrence was filed. And I had discussions with the forester, and I said, you need to resolve this before we take it for an individual waiver. And that's where that language has risen out of as well. So it's not just us. It does happen to others. So,
Mr. Shallcross?
Yeah, let me get the timing on this right. The timber harvest plan and any possible non-concurrence would happen anyway or before a waiver, right? Before
yes,
they
sir.
Came to us for a waiver.
Yes, sir.
So that would all have to be resolved one way or the other.
Absolutely.
If there was a non-concurrence that we didn't like or that we felt was threatening of water quality and we didn't think CDF was addressing, couldn't we include that in the waiver?
Absolutely. We could.
So I don't see what we gain by making them, I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's the reason for us to do this is if they're not doing the proper protections for water quality, we have to take that responsibility.
Right. And other agencies have responsibility for other areas of the environment. I don't know.
We just simply don't want to get caught in an administrative black hole where we have a water quality issue that's holding up a waiver, and we don't have a waiver process where we have due process in commenting and working that through.
Well, it's not really a due process issue, because if the waiver were rejected, you would have the opportunity to get an individual waiver. But it seems like if our concern is making sure that we have input on these non-concurrences from the local agencies, we could change this just to limit it to non-concurrences by us that aren't resolved, and just make sure that the local agencies are aware that they need to notify us when they have concerns, and if we share those concerns, we can non-concur.
And we still have to get a waiver from you regardless.
So what language would
be... Well, except there would have to be something in the non-concurrence that would cause the THP not to meet one of the conditions, or it would be eligible for enrollment. And it could be that condition C, that the executive officer determines that it's likely to adversely affect the quality or beneficial uses of water.
But it sounded to me like staff's main concern was in a case where CDF, in our opinion or someone else's opinion, blew off the non-concurrence. And then it sounds to me like staff was afraid that at that point we would have no recourse. And so that's why we're holding the waiver hostage. Am I not getting it right?
No, we always have recourse because we could say that we believe that that practice is adversely affecting water quality, therefore you don't apply. Or you can't comply with the conditions of the order. The intent with that was to try and get more local dialogue and have the resolution at the local level, because we don't want to get caught in somebody filing a non-concurrence and then we have to go through an additional. I was trying to streamline the process in reality. Say, solve it at the local level. Come to us once it's resolved. And then once it's resolved, we get a resolved THP and we can move forward with our process.
This doesn't force CDF to do that. I mean, they can still blow off things, and yeah, the forester doesn't get a waiver from us, but so.
How is that different than what this gentleman suggested?
Come again? I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well, once it's resolved, what you're saying is by CDF, because CDF's the one that ultimately resolves non-concurrences, right?
Yes.
So what's wrong with then adding by CDF?
There is.
I
don't have a problem with adding by CDF.
Okay, good.
I just wanted to make.
Okay. Jeez. All right.
I don't understand though, because
Mr. Berlage,
what we have without that condition.
Yeah, but I just wanted to make sure that people knew that it was a condition of the order and that it had to be resolved, and it's going to come to our attention as part of the process.
His new language says as long as CDF quote resolves it, it's done. I mean, yes, we have our own processes.
Yes.
But it means as long as CDF somehow addresses it, then it's done.
Right, but if it's in our order and that's there, they're going to pay more attention to it because they know we're going to be looking at it. And that's what I'm trying to get across. Do it at a local level, get it resolved, address the water quality issues before it gets to the regional board.
Well, I don't agree that this language does that. I thought the intent of the language was to make sure the non-concurrence was removed by the non-concurrer so that eliminate CDF's ability to just blow things off. If the non-concurrence can be resolved by CDF in any manner, including just blowing it off, then this doesn't add anything, because if CDF doesn't resolve it, they don't get a THP or an NTMP, and they're not eligible for the waiver.
The reason why, you're correct, but it's in the interpretation. In the narrow sense you're talking about, it's the interpretation of resolved. I just wanted to make sure that you understood it was resolved by going through the CDF process. If you were to ask an agency that had an issue that CDF did not feel was adequate and turn around and ask them if the issue was resolved, they'd tell you no.
Right.
So I just want to make sure that within this section, resolved means that CDF has taken the appropriate statutory action, whatever that might be, and dealt with the non-concurrence in a legal manner.
Well, I understand that, but from what you're saying, it's legal for CDF to just, we're using the term blow them off, but
well, that's
maybe
a little
just
harsh,
disagree
but,
where
right.
we would yeah. agree right. with the non-concurrence, but if that's the case, then this paragraph has zero legal effect because CDF has to resolve it in order to grant the THP, and without a THP, there's no waiver.
Do we need to add another word like successfully resolve or appropriately resolve?
Well, no, that's too vague. But
can we say retracted, Laurie?
Yeah. Removed or retracted. But that doesn't address the concern, if it is a concern to the board, that for political reasons that would allow local entities to hold the waiver hostage.
I just don't want the waiver process to go into a black hole because of this clause. Maybe that isn't an issue, and I am not an attorney. We had concerns in looking at that because the language seems sort of vague.
Well, it's up to the board whether they want this provision in or out of the waiver, and my concern is just making sure that everyone understands the legal impacts of the language.
Lori, do we have the option of saying something like the issues in the non-concurrence related to water quality must be resolved by the executive officer? Because that's really what we're concerned about. If somebody files a non-concurrence and it has water quality concerns, we want to address them.
Yeah, I think that's better than putting CDF in the loop. I mean, it's our responsibility, not theirs.
I think that really falls under 4C, that if the non-concurrence, if the reasons for the non-concurrence cause the executive officer to conclude that the activity is likely to adversely affect water quality, then there won't be a waiver. But saying that something will be resolved to the EO's satisfaction.
Seems redundant.
I have a problem with that.
It's redundant, and it's...
I have a problem with that because what that can do is hold up the process again. Because I think what we can do, if there's a non-concurrence that affects water quality, and I think we can address that in the waiver itself as a condition, can't we? Address the concurrence in the waiver as a condition. Add a condition to the waiver that says you must do X, Y, and Z, which will address the non-concurrence that was brought up that would, you know, adversely affect water quality, and then go forward with the process of issuing the waiver, which is what these guys want.
No, this is a general waiver, and that's adding conditions for a site-specific plan. And they can do that by getting an individual waiver.
That's what I'm saying. So why do we need...
Oh, yeah, no. Yeah. Well, then, yeah. You can do that.
So what I'm saying is, so we don't need to have the issue addressed before the waiver is issued. Because that's yet another step. It's like, okay, go take care of that water issue and then come back and request your waiver. That's what I don't want to happen.
Well, no, you do need to do that. If you want to add a condition to the waiver for a specific project, you have to add the condition before the waivers.
You add the condition in the waiver, but they can do it. They can do it during the period of the waiver.
But you have to adopt the waiver to add the condition.
No. Okay, you're missing it. If they have to go fix something because there's going to be a water problem, it sounds to me like what you're saying is the EO could say, go fix it, and then come back and apply for your waiver. And it may be something that's a sort of a timely thing that takes them some time to take care of. Maybe some bank, thing they've got to fix. So why not just say, come ask for your waiver, and in the waiver, one of the conditions is you fix this bank within...
Because you can't do that with a general waiver.
It's adding conditions to the waiver.
Once they file the notice of intent to enroll, that starts a clock ticking.
We could definitely put in a statement that says, if there's this non-concurrent situation, then an individual waiver is required.
Right.
And then that could have anything that's needed.
Yeah, but that...
Right, and that's
what
all these conditions do.
But that could slow things down for the applicant.
Yeah.
Well, but still, I mean, that's the same kind of thing we're putting on. This then encourages the applicant to, resolve it upstream. If it gets resolved upstream, then it's not an issue when it gets to us, and a general waiver would apply. Otherwise, a general waiver is required.
Well, how about if we just take the paragraph out?
I think that would probably be fine.
Can we do that, Howard?
Yes.
Mr. Berlage?
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Berlage?
Yes.
We'll take the paragraph out.
Thank you.
If you could come up, I didn't want to spend a lot of time with this, but I had something else that I wanted to just kind of bounce off you. I know you were here for our previous ACL matters, and you saw that we had a civil engineer who had a lot of experience, supposedly, doing erosion control practices, and who thought he was doing a good job. And, I mean, we spent a lot of time dealing with what I think was pretty obvious, at least to us and maybe members of the audience, that you know, there are situations where people think they're doing the right thing and they're creating a nuisance and a pollution problem.
Right.
I certainly would hope that, you know, and I know that we have some foresters here, that I hope you guys really understand, you know, the BMPs, the erosion control devices, and how to adequately maintain them so that we don't have to end up in an ACL hearing
right.
with forestry. I mean, that would be my hope, like with any of the people that we regulate.
Right. Well, agreed. And I would hope that this board would understand that, as opposed to that previous case, and I don't want to get in trouble by interjecting myself into that, although I've certainly got some opinions about it. The CDF process, you can look at that as a filter. That would have never happened with something like a CDF process and review. And I mean, there, you know, I agree. I don't think anybody was malicious there. It was just a terrible communication breakdown. Probably some people that, you know, rules and regulations and laws of the state have changed underneath those people without their knowledge, and frankly, there would be no way for them to know. Probably a different story for the people who were advising the landowners, but I don't want to go into detail about that either. What I would like to say is that something analogous to that could not happen. Not only would we not want that to happen, and everything that my company does is done to avoid things like that, but we have a process that runs concurrent with yours that's looking at that stuff before you do, and that's the CDF process.
Well,
but I understand you have a responsibility, and we want to help you uphold that responsibility.
Well, I appreciate that, and I understand what you're saying. However, we do have, you know, the anti-timber folks, if you want to label them as that, making allegations that there are problems that continue to occur on THPs, and so
I want to support them in a couple of their recommendations. Every single one of them tonight has said, get out on the PHIs and conduct post-harvest inspections. Amen to those notions. Mm-hmm. We're completely supportive of that.
Okay. Mr. Daniels?
I'd like to take some exception to what you said, that this could never happen under the THP process. I mean, there are, for example, very clear laws on the books that say you're not supposed to rob banks. And that doesn't mean that banks are never robbed. I mean, things happen irregardless of the process. And that's one of the reasons we're trying to do this process, is to kind of act as a backup. That
right.
things that, mistakes that happen at that level that might not be caught at that level, we can catch at our level.
Agreed.
And that's,
Agreed.
Indeed the issue here is, you know, what kind of things do we need to put in place to make sure we're doing our
right.
duty to protect
right.
water quality?
But you can have laws against robbing a bank, and that's not going to prevent someone from robbing a bank. You got to deal with it after the fact and throw them in jail.
We right.
have no intentions of robbing the bank.
Thank you.
Murder laws keep me from killing.
Especially at this hour, right? Mr. Van Lennep.
I had a quick question before my time starts. Do I have three or six, since I put down for two items?
You have six.
I'll be as brief as possible. Thank you. My name is David Van Lennep, registered professional forester. I currently work for Redwood Empire Sawmills. I'd like to refer you to the letter that I hope you have in front of you, constructed by local resource professionals. We had some minor but very important requests for modifications in the waiver, some of which you've heard already from Mr. Berlage. I'd like to address just briefly one of those, which is the in-stream monitoring language for Class 2 watercourses. Currently, it's worded that all Class 2 watercourses will be monitored, and I understand that staff has put in a modification to that language, that the sites will be chosen on the pre-harvest inspection, which is somewhat better. But I would like to suggest that be deferred for some period of time until staff can evaluate the monitoring data that they have available. They stated they had 14,000 monitoring points or monitoring bits of data that they needed to compile. They've got historic data and other data that may show that, A, there's no problems, which would be supported by the lack of any 303D listing of temperature-listed impairment in the Santa Cruz Mountains. And it may save some small landowners from having to go out and do a considerable amount of expense to implement this before there's any real causation or any acknowledgement that there's actually any problem. We would support monitoring in Class 1 water courses if for no other reason than just to provide some additional data to the board and to other sources. But Class 2s are highly variable, and the considerable protections that exist for all water courses within the forest practice rules provide a considerable amount of protection, are already a considerable expense, and it would be more transparent to us, if you will, if staff would have some time or be allowed some time to compile the data that they've collected from us and from others and make some analysis before implementing that across the board. If the board wishes, the language could be left in to be activated at the executive officer's decision, if you will. Just asking that the implementation of that on every waiver be deferred for some period of time. I'd like to address a couple of other things that the board has heard here in these discussions. The additional BMPs that are required under some of these other waivers and other orders covering timber operations are by and large to guide them towards the kind of result that we get here day in and day out with no oversight. The example of leaving X number of trees on a landslide is, say, in a even age management where they would have in the past cut all the trees off a landslide. We have typically California Geologic Survey and private consulting geologists review slides on the harvest plan area and make specific recommendations like that in the harvest plan. There's rules that exist, the threatened and impaired rules, that demand review by a geologist under certain conditions near water courses, and those things are implemented day in and day out. So I just wanted the board to be clear that in other regions where they have 4,000-acre harvest plans come in, they're trying to get a handle on some of the things that we do here day in and day out. Not all those places have the kind of management by statute that we have here. And I'd also like to address the 15-year CER reentry time frame. I don't have the exact information on why that was set at 10 years, but it's set at 10 years throughout the whole state, and it's part of the cumulative effects ratio for everyone in the state, or the cumulative effects analysis in each THP. So I have a high suspicion that if you talk to CDF, they could provide the rationale for using 10 years. And again, my suspicions, and I have not been able to find documentation for this, is that it has something to do with recovery periods. And when under scientific research, they found that the impacts that they had noted from various harvests were no longer noticeable. In Santa Cruz, the 15-year stretch or the 14-year wait in harvest reentry was primarily a growth and yield issue. It had to do with long-term yield of high-quality timber products and did not have to do with recovery periods and those kinds of things. It was a growth issue. This particular waiver is requiring more monitoring and will require us to submit more information and be more in touch with the board than any other place in the state. And all this on top of what is arguably the most solidified forest practice program, whether you're looking at the forest practice rules themselves or the individual landowners that implement them, anywhere in the state and probably anywhere in the country. And the only thing that has kept the California forest practice rules from being certified as BMPs is a monitoring component. That was the only thing. There was no necessarily fault with the actual way the rules were implemented. There have been studies about problems in certain areas, all of which pertains to other parts of the state. The hill slope monitoring program, which did look at harvest in Santa Cruz, and they found a certain percentage of crossings that had some kind of problem. Most of those were very, very minor, and the criterion for calling it a problem was very low. So even in the hill slope monitoring, there's only a few, maybe one or two out of 30 or 40 harvests that were in the Central Coast region.
Okay.
I would request that the board pass the general waiver and allow us a process to move forward. Thank you for your time.
Any questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Nadia Hamey and then Matt Diaz.
Evening, Chairman, members of the board. My name is Nadia Hamey. I'm a registered professional forester for Big Creek Lumber Company. And first of all, I would like to thank staff for the tremendous effort put into putting together this negative declaration and general waiver. And I would like to ask that you consider the letter prepared by professional foresters in the Central Coast region and sent to Mr. Briggs, and the points that my colleagues have already mentioned. And I'd just like to touch on one other point in that letter. And I get the sense that everyone is in agreement that the monitoring and reporting program needs to be reevaluated and revisited, and that our data needs to be analyzed so that we can tell how useful it is, because it's very expensive for these small THPs to be collecting turbidity measurements and temperature measurements. And we want to make sure that they're actually providing the answers to the questions that your board is asking. I believe that our forest practices, and I assure you, and my colleagues as well, are well aware of BMPs and their effectiveness, and we consistently propose upgrades on timber harvest plans and NTMPs to improve watercourse crossings. And I only wish that you could be out on the ground, as your staff is, to see how the selective timber harvesting is occurring in the southern subdistrict. It's a stark contrast to other places in the state. And a lot of the documentation that was submitted as comment saying the negative declaration was not adequate was assessing situations in other parts of the state that are not regulated, as we are in the southern subdistrict. So if you have any questions, I'll answer them. Otherwise, that's my comments.
Thank you. Any questions? All right. Thank you very much.
Welcome.
Last speaker, believe it or not. Matt Diaz.
How long have you been waiting for?
Let's make it good, Matt.
All right, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. I'd like to start by introducing myself. My name is Matt Diaz. I'm a registered professional forester with Big Creek Lumber Company, as well as Nadia is. I want to thank you for allowing me to testify. I had written down this afternoon, but we are now into the evening, so thank you for letting me testify this evening. They have also mentioned the letter that was drafted by resource professionals from the Central Coast, and so I would like to ask you guys to please review that letter. And there have been four topics that were discussed in that letter. I am going to address one of them, mine being the language involved or that is currently inserted into the negative declaration and the general waiver pertaining to the mapping of skid trails being mandatory to apply for a conditional waiver under the general waiver. I would like to delete that language. I would like to propose to delete that language, as our letter does, and insert the formula of 100 feet per acre into the CER, and I feel that would actually address the issue of skid trails. I could go into why the restrictions of having all skid trails mapped. You know, we could go into the forest practice rules doesn't require that, or... what am I trying to say? That the forest privacy rules doesn't require that mapping of all skid trails is mandatory, but it really, really gets down to it. Brass tacks-wise, it's operational. When you're out in the field on ground-based operations, you have to have some kind of flexibility and leeway to get that ground-based equipment around to function properly in the field. So in terms of safety of your operators, safety of the people on the ground, and not only that, but safety of people that be using the sites for recreation post-harvest, this all has to be considered when we're dealing with ground-based equipment. Secondly, it is possible that the term skid trail be contentious, I guess, in areas where ground-based equipment would be off a designated skid trail on a map, but not being used to actually skid logs, but rather maybe aiding other equipment and moving around or implementing erosion control structures of this duties of this nature could potentially have track marks left in the woods that could be designated or be determined to be skid trails. And then your operators would be in conflict with the general waiver because they are not on the exact trail mapped on a map that was submitted with the THP. I'm going to keep this short. That's all I really have to say. There are some really operational restrictions that go along with making mandatory skid trails mapped and making ground-based equipment stay on those skid trails. It just doesn't work. It's just not feasible. So if there's any questions, I will answer them. If not, I will let you go on and end this meeting for the evening.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, the letter that they keep referring to, the Central Coast Regional Foresters letter, is dated yesterday. Howard gave us some copies. It's not in the record. It was received very late. I think that most of the items in this letter have already been addressed in the comments, but you need to rule on whether or not to admit it. None of the board members have seen this.
We haven't seen it. It's too late. I think for that purpose, it's... You know, we can't all read it. Staff hasn't read it. I don't know what how the board feels.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Why don't we have Mr. Briggs and staff wrap this up for us?
Well, I'd like to start with staff trying to summarize the where we are as far as changes. We've heard quite a few changes suggested, discussed as we've gone along here.
The two significant changes to the order that I've heard about are page 6, item E, 1E, which is if the resource agencies file a non-concurrence, the board recommend or has been discussing deleting that paragraph. Item F is the skid trails. There's been a number of comments that they'd like that language deleted from the order and replaced with a 100 feet lineal feet per acre. If we were to delete that language from the order, that 100 feet lineal feet per acre would end up as a calculation in the soil disturbance factor as part of the eligibility criteria.
What are you recommending?
I recommend that we could do that, that we put it in the soil disturbance factor.
Do you think that's the right number to use?
Oh, that's a good question.
Yeah. That's the key question.
Yeah. I don't know if I can answer that right now. I've heard numbers of up to 11% disturbance in an acre. But how you would calculate that as a square footage, I don't have a literature value to go off of at this point in time. So now again, the eligibility criteria is a tool we use, and we will constantly be looking at it and evaluating it. And it could be added, and we could bring back some results and tell the board how it works and change it if necessary.
Personally, I would say if we don't have any assurance this is the right number, sticking a random number in is not a wise thing to do.
I agree.
I'd say leave it the way it is.
as it says right now.
Yep.
We don't change it.
Yep.
It's page 6. The order.
I don't know, that sort of throws out any consideration of what the foresters were saying about that particular point.
Well, it should be 1, should be 100, should be 2,000.
If staff has no basis to assess whether this is the appropriate number, I don't think that the board should put it in.
I mean, one of the things that was talked about is the sunset thing, and if we're going to bring this back in 2.5 years, then maybe we address it then.
I actually have a recommendation on the sunset thing.
Well,
bet you do.
Go ahead, Lori.
I think we missed sunset tonight.
I'm hoping we're still not here for sunrise. I don't think that it's a good idea because the board can revise or terminate or revoke the waiver at any time. If you put a sunset provision in, then you have to revisit it even if you don't want to or you want to revisit it in 2.5 or 3 years, and it unnecessarily ties the board's hands and could result in the waiver rescinding itself when you don't want it to.
What was the 100 based on? Where'd that number come from?
That number was provided by the forest professionals. I don't have a basis for that number.
Okay. Maybe Mr. Van Lennep could.
Mr. Van Lennep or Ms.
Can you answer that?
May I answer a question?
Could you answer that question?
Yes, I generated that number by looking at, if you look at a square acre, in theory, 200 feet by 200 feet, you would need at least 100 feet of trail if you were going to mainline tractor trail access to that 200 by 200 foot square. If you drew a line into that and looked out at the edges and formulated how the timber would be felled into that area where you had that one section of trail, it works out to be 100 feet. I proofed it against a couple of different plans, and I measured the length of map trail on plans that I was very familiar with, and it worked out in that range. What I was trying to do by providing that number was allow staff to have something to add into the calculation of the soil disturbance factor and still provide us the ability to move around on, and we're not talking on trails that are constructed, because constructed skid trails need to be mapped. We're talking about places where a tractor would go one time or maybe a number of times that would be necessary for the proper mechanics of the job. You wouldn't want to necessarily restrict the operator to have to pull all the trees that were felled from the backside of a clump of redwoods through the middle of the clump, because he couldn't go around on completely moderate ground to pull them out in a different manner. So it's a logistics, it's a safety, it makes for a better job, and we as foresters are accustomed to allowing that to occur within the bounds of the forest practice rules, and that's how our operators assess that. So I was trying to allow us to continue on with laying the harvest plans out in that way and still provide staff a way to analyze that. If board felt that that was too high or too low, they could adjust that number around. I was providing that as just kind of my rough cut of what would be logical.
I think that
the
question is logical.
What does staff think about it?
They recommended it.
No. They originally thought it was a good idea.
Yeah.
What do you think about that rationale?
Mr. Chair, can I ask David a couple questions?
Yeah.
David, do you agree with that, with Howard's number of 11% disturbance in an acre?
He got that from me, so yes.
So what about...
Kind of circular reasoning going on here.
Well, what's the typical width of a skid trail?
Typical width of a skid trail is around 10 feet wide. And let me condition that. The 11% number was a number that was generated, I believe, by some research done on some of Big Creek's harvest back in the mid-'80s and confirmed by some other non-published kind of research on soil disturbance in general on tractor ground or tractor-operated timber harvest plans, and that was an average number.
Couldn't you take the square footage in an acre, reduce it to 11% of that, and then divide it by the width of the skid trail and get a number?
I'd have to put a pencil to it, but the square footage of an acre is 43,560.
Right.
And so if you took 11% of that, that would be roughly, what,
4,700?
Yeah,
4,730.
And then divide that by the width of the...
Divided by 10?
Would be 470 feet.
Square feet?
Feet.
No, feet.
I would say that any of my operators who drove 473 feet around a 200-foot square would be in trouble with me. So I would say that that's too high. We're talking about mainline skid trails. This is the issue that staff wanted to try to get a handle on, was the areas that were being operated in tractor ground where we're not required under the rules for various reasons to map every single location where tractors will operate. Now, that's not to say that there are not restrictions. It's just that we're not required on ground that's less than 50% to map exact locations for that. And our concern is that operators will be either potentially in violation of the order by taking the tractors off the trail to do a better job, or they will be restricted to these areas that we have to lay out and get approved ahead of time without their input. And there could be other ramifications for that. That's the impetus behind our comment.
Well, definitely one of the things about doing this is it's going to encourage folks to not map if this is the wrong kind of number. And like the CDF was asking for, agreeing that this is a good thing to require us, because they want to see maps too.
Can I respond to that?
Sure. Clay Brandau with CDF. The rules on mapping skid trails are very specific, and so there wouldn't be any diminution of the mapping requirements by this. All this would do would be to capture this number of unmapped skid trails for the purposes of this determination in your waiver.
I think this is reasonable to me.
And we have the option of changing it down the line if it turns out to be way off base.
And we're fine with it.
All right, so I would suggest that striking letter F on page 6 of the order.
I did disagree with this, but it sounds like I'm overruled. So.
I didn't hear what you just said.
I disagree with this change, but sounds like there's at least I'm surrounded by people supporting it. So.
We can always change it later. It doesn't work.
And that means adding your language about 100 lineal feet per acre to the SDF.
Yes.
Right.
Okay, continue, Mr. Kolb.
Could we just have about 3 to 5 minutes just to put this all together so it's clear and concise?
Okay, that's fine.
Like,
sure.
Maybe more like 10.
Okay, we are going to continue our meeting. And Chris, is staff ready to continue with its wrap-up?
Just 30 seconds. I'm going to get Dr.
Malone. Okay. What?
Okay, are we ready?
Well, I guess we need a board. And
board? What kind of board? 2x4, 4x4? Two by four between the eyes?
Yeah. Well, I don't think I'd even feel it right now.
Probably not. I'm with you there, Russ. You got a problem with a numb brain. Are they in the hall?
Okay. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Got a quorum.
Okay. Why don't you?
By the time they do their thing, there.
Howard, go ahead.
Okay. These are the changes that staff is proposing to the, I believe it's the June 29th version of documents that you have in front of you. The first would be to delete paragraph 1E, page 6. That's the non-concurrence paragraph. The second would be to delete 1F, which is the skid trail language, and concurrent with that, add to the soil disturbance factor the language for 100 linear feet per acre. I think that's what we agreed on. We are also going to add to the order a finding that the forester will notify regional board staff concurrently when they are applying for a minor or major amendment, so we know ahead of time before it goes through the CDF process. We're going to work on developing a standard reporting form for hours and rainfall and make sure that gets out to the dischargers. That's not necessarily a change to the order, but that's just something we're going to do. In the monitoring reporting program, we're going to put a quotations around the year one language so that individuals understand that that has a definite meaning as identified in the monitoring reporting program. And then in the order, we were going to add a finding which stated that for all Tier 2 and Tier 3 for the next 24 months, they will be required to do Tier 3 monitoring. And then there was a suggestion that we return within 30 months to present that data, and staff intends to do that. Then there was the issue of winter operations, and we're going to propose that language be incorporated that say, any heavy equipment off an all-weather road would kick them up a tier, as Mr. Daniel suggested. And the reason we're doing that is that we do have winter operations that are not involving heavy equipment. They do tree falling and other things like that, and we didn't necessarily feel that that should kick them up a tier in monitoring. And then the last thing would be the sunset clause, where there was some discussion about sunsetting in 2 years. Staff will be coming back to the board with a data summary along that same time period. So if the board desires to review the waiver or change the waiver, we can be directed to do that at that time. So there is no real need to put a sunset clause in this current waiver. And that's it.
Well, we conflabbed on that. Just amplifying that last point, the point is that we would plan to, we have the 24 months of data, and then within 30 months, so 6 months after we have that, we'd be bringing that back to the board for review. But we think that would suffice as opposed to having a sunset clause in the order. I want to make sure that was clear.
Okay. Any discussion by the board? How did you leave the 15 years instead of 10 years status?
I did not address that.
So you don't feel it's necessary?
Not at this time, but...
All right, then I don't know how the rest of the board feels about this.
I would support it.
Changing it to 15 years in the CER. Yeah, I'd kind of like that, too. I think that's important.
Well, I would support it, but I'm concerned about the fact that folks can go back in after 10 years. So is that a problem with doing 15?
You mean in the way it's counted?
Yeah.
Because there's double counting?
Because you can have two timber.
It's a more conservative value, but it's not a problem. It just creates a more conservative number.
I can support it.
All right.
Is it
time for a motion?
I would
motion.
I have three things additionally.
Okay, good.
One was the issue that Dr. Press brought up, that this is a backstop, so we allow things to be added, but we don't allow, you know, tiers to be just kind of gotten rid of. But, you know, this is kind of the minimum requirements. So.
Your language you want to propose?
Well, just that, that, you know, that you know, what the determination of the tier according to the equations, you can increase the monitoring and the tier things, but you can't just take things away.
Based on other facts.
Based on other factors.
Do you want that as a finding in the order, or do you just want to make that a policy?
I think it should be in the order.
Okay. Can we put that in the order?
What?
Can we put that the eligibility criteria is a backstop, that you have to meet that level of monitoring?
You could do that. It would remove some of the flexibility that the executive officer and staff have, but it would be legal.
Well, I'd say, you know, if it's felt that's really needed, then it could be brought back as an individual waiver, and it could be anything it wants to be. But according to this general thing, this is sort of the minimums. Okay.
Is there specific language you have for that?
It's a backstop.
Well, aren't you really talking about a change to the second paragraph of the monitoring reporting program?
Yes, I am. Yes, we are. So, after the first sentence of that second paragraph, or maybe after the at the end of that paragraph, it might read, THPs or NTMPs that are categorized as tier 1, 2, or 3 by use of the eligibility criteria cannot be downgraded. It really is, it actually really should be tiers 2 or 3 or 4 cannot be downgraded to a lower category once they have been
determined using the criteria.
Yeah, I'm really tired.
How about if we say
based on other criteria?
Yeah. Yeah.
However, the executive officer may not
downgrade a waiver.
May not score a THP or an NTMP as a lower tier once the EC have.
However, the executive officer may not change the monitoring requirements so that they're less stringent than the monitoring requirements that would apply based on the tier that applies under the eligibility criteria.
Sure.
Okay, I'd like to consider removing that particular one egregious sentence about, you know, the forest practice rules guarantee no environmental impact. And I think the reason we're doing this is we're not necessarily certain that FPRs guarantee impacts against waters are taken care of.
Well, actually what we said is that CDF is ensured compliance. And what I mean by that is they've gone out and conducted enforcement inspections and made people comply. That doesn't mean there haven't been problems, because you get a problem, then they go out and make them comply. I want to make one thing clear is we haven't relied on the forest practice rules. We're relying on the conditions of our order to protect water quality. And so I just want to make sure that's clear to the board.
Where is that phrase?
I don't know where that is.
Someone must know,
Jody,
where it is.
You found that, so where is it? So we can kill it.
Oh.
It's not okay. It's not.
Then we're safe.
No, it's not in the order then.
Oh, okay. All right. And then the final thing is I'd like to consider this Chris Berry suggestion about the canopy reduction of Class 2 water courses, you know, where he talks about the fact that this regulation with a 10 to 14 year reentry period will maintain these water courses in a perpetual state of adolescence. So I'd like to
see about adding that suggestion of his.
Could you say that louder, Mr. Daniels?
Yeah, I'd be glad to. In here he mentions that the existing FPRs allow a reduction of total canopy within the Lopez of Class II watercourses to 50% and only require that 25% of the overstory of conifers. And he says, this regulation with a 10 to 14 year reentry period will maintain these watercourses in a perpetual state of adolescence and disturbance. So I would like to consider making the amount that's set aside for that higher, like 75%?
For
the
canopy cover?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, we typically don't regulate timber harvest practices. We would have to make a finding relative to water quality. So we just need to restructure the directive so that it gets at a temperature issue or a, and the conditions of the order as they're now worded say they will not alter temperature. If there are other issues, we do have in our basin plan chapter 5 page 13 sub paragraph 4 that says dischargers or wherever possible a 30-foot riparian corridor will be maintained on all watercourses. And so we have that requirement. But one of the things about timber harvest practices is they usually have a riparian corridor when they're done, so I don't know that that would add a great deal. We need to do something like that as opposed to regulate canopy cover.
Oh, okay. All right.
A question on that, right. And maybe it's one for Lori. Even though it's it doesn't sound directly water quality related, business of canopy, but What Mr. Berry is talking about is large woody debris.
42.
And so if it's a concern about removing habitat or limiting habitat, doesn't that go to beneficial use protection?
Yes, and it also affects temperature, which is a water quality issue.
Well, that's what Howard was saying, is we have to restructure for temperature, but I was thinking if we also looked at it in terms of the habitat that it provides, it's a beneficial use protection measure.
So what are you proposing?
I was just thinking we wouldn't have to rely strictly on the temperature aspect of it, and we therefore could deal with the canopy directly, as Mr. Berry was referring to.
Right, but what change are you proposing?
We're on page 43, left column there. I guess he's just saying what the problem is as opposed to proposing change. Mr. Daniels, I don't know if you can help out with
that.
Yeah,
I'm looking for, trying to think of something, too. It talks about the cut disturbance buffer should be included as a condition of the waivers.
Is this something that if it's a problem, it'll show up in 2 years and we'll be able to?
It'll show up this winter. You know, the conditions of the order say protect water quality, and hopefully once this waiver is adopted, we can direct the current staff resources to doing adoption of this to get out in the field and follow up on this. Since November of last year, we've only been able to conduct 10 post-harvest inspections, and we've probably conducted equal or more pre-harvest inspections.
Since you have the most temperature data, more than any other thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe this is the sort of thing that you take a look at over the next 30 months.
Oh, absolutely. We've hired a student who's working on it right now. We're going through the literature. We're looking at temperature protocol. The data that I showed you today on the San Lorenzo was some data they've already pulled down and made available.
Would you have a way of analyzing THP data and finding out if temperature temperatures were higher in THPs with more or less canopy in the in the wheel pad.
You mean to relate it back to class one, class two?
Yeah.
I don't know yet.
Well,
We will be looking at that. The forest practice rules require the same canopy cover for class ones throughout the Santa Cruz region, same canopy cover for class two. So we will be looking at.
Okay. The question really is, do the THPs provide enough data about canopy? Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah. Well, the THPs will provide data on the class ones and class twos where we measure temperature. What I'm hoping is that we'll be able to begin to look at all that data across and pull in the ambient temperature and air temperature and.
Well, maybe that can be something that. Okay.
We don't really have a good fallback criterion.
Okay.
Anything else, Mr. Daniels?
Just like to mention, I'm not sure about the DDI weightings issue. I'm kind of worried that we got all this feedback from both sides saying that our weightings are wrong, but I think that's something we should look at. And I think we should also look at the various BMP practices. Maybe at the same time as we're looking at the monitoring data, we need to look at which of these BMP practices might make sense to add to the next version of this. So that's it.
Okay. Any other board comments or questions? All right. Do we need to have...
Is there any way that we could shed light on one other topic that you just discussed, one change, or is this completely closed and we're done for the night?
Come on up.
I just have one concern when I'm listening to the changes real quick. You were talking about if winter operations were proposed within a THP that it would automatically kick you up a tier.
Heavy equipment.
If you had heavy equipment, ground-based equipment.
Off on all weather roads.
Off winter roads, which, I mean, that's basically, if you have ground-based equipment proposed for winter ops, that's going to occur. And so if we got most, when we're running our calculations for our eligibility criteria, most ground-based operations have already been kicked up into Tier 3, so by proposing winter operations with ground-based equipment, we're automatically going to get kicked to Tier 4, and that's an individual waiver. Is that correct? Is that the way that would occur? So winter operations with ground-based is going to almost guarantee an individual waiver from here on out. Which is pretty much... Okay. All right, that doesn't seem to make the timeliness of the process very feasible. I mean,
the alternative was to mess with the weighting of winter ops,
but so that might have the same effect.
It might have the same effect depending on what weight you choose. I calculated that using a 100% weighting for winter ops would indeed kick you up into a lot more of the next tier. If you used 1.75 or 1.5, you're splitting the difference. So, it's a question. It's another balancing of different flexibility on the one hand and more soil disturbance in the winter. So I wonder what staff thinks about this, because
I mean, it's just slightly contradictory, because we try to involve winter ops for dry periods operational during dry periods of the winter, but if we can't get the waiver, your flexibility is lost anyways because there's no planning. So, I mean, it's just kind of contradictory.
No, I understand.
I'll sit down.
But, you could help us out by answering my original question, which was if we were going to use a weight in that... In soil disturbance factor, the weight that staff had proposed was a 20% weight. It could have been some other number. So what I'm saying and what I'm hearing you say is that if you go too far with the weight, whether it's 100% or an automatic kicking up into the next tier, then you've made that the determinative factor. So propose something else that has some technical rationale. by a different weight, for example. 50%?
Well, I don't know where staff got the 20%, and I don't really, I can't really verify a 20, 25, 50% myself. I think the most applicable thing would, because winter operations with ground-based equipment to propose that is fairly common. And so I would say that, you know, I could see going into Tier 3 and making the Tier 3 monitoring strategy applicable to all winter ground-based winter operation plans, but taking up the board's time with individual waivers just because winter operation plans are proposed.
Okay, that's a good idea. You could. What you're suggesting is if you have winter ops with ground-based equipment, you're automatically in Tier 3?
I would say that would be better than kicking us into individual waivers.
Okay,
every time.
And then.
But aren't they already mostly?
Then unless there's some other reason for going up into Tier 4, which the executive officer has the discretion of doing, you're not going to go there,
okay,
unless you say so.
I think our concern with winter operations is excess sediment, excess turbidity, and so Tier 3 would capture that.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. That's what Mr. Diaz is just saying, is why not accept a Tier 3 for THB's winter ops, ground-based equipment, and leave it. Do not say that you're bumped up automatically into the next category because that could be number 4.
Right.
You're just saying, all you're saying about winter ops is that you're in 3. Now, there still is discretion in the MRP for the executive officer to kick a 3 into a 4 at any time.
Correct.
So this doesn't affect that. But it doesn't automatically kick you into a 4 like you were worried.
Yeah, it just doesn't default you into a 4 automatically without the EO's discretion.
Okay, can we add that? What do people think about that?
I like it.
That's fine with staff.
So the language would be, added to the MRP, I guess.
And just to capture a little more, I think, of where you're going with this, we always have the latitude to add additional monitoring.
Right.
And I think that's your concern, is making sure that things aren't happening that are so if they're automatically in Tier 3 and we're out there evaluating, I think that will cover it.
Yeah. Right. So you got it?
Well, clarification then. Are we just going to define it as winter ops, or as we were talking about before with heavy equipment off of all weather roads?
We were going to say ground based equipment, and that
off
would,
of all weather roads.
Yeah, off of all weather roads.
Right.
Okay.
That's acceptable to me. I would strike the winter ops weight from the SDF at this point because it's redundant and useless. Okay.
Good.
Well, it's not redundant for Class 3 things, and that still can kick a Class 3 into a 4 if they're winter ops. So.
But that was the point that Mr. Diaz raised, that if it it'd be double jeopardy, basically. You'd already be in – you're saying if you were already in a 3 without the winter weight, and then you added another 20% weight,
it could kick it to a 4.
Yeah, but I think you've got the discretion from the EO to really look at a 4 and whether it warrants an individual waiver.
We can look at it again in 30 months.
Okay, any more changes?
Change,
well, no, I was just going to say that ground-based equipment off-road winter ops issue is going to go in the monitoring and reporting program.
Right.
Okay.
Okay. Someone can either make a motion or staff can make a new recommendation.
I'll move staff recommendation with the changes that have been described.
Well, just procedurally, you need to adopt the neg deck first and then adopt the waiver. Yeah. And I have some changes to the resolution adopting the neg deck. If you can see those. I thought that Mr. Daniels made an excellent point at the beginning of the hearing about the initial study not being clear enough that the project is the waiver, which is an overlaid regulatory structure on top of the forest practice rules, and that we're not approving timber harvesting because we don't have jurisdiction to do that. So that's what these changes clarify. And is that enough time? And then I just made two changes to make findings that the two provisions that were deleted from the initial study, the two from the order in the initial study, are insignificant, basically. And the XXX there is just this language regarding the formula for the 100 lineal feet that I didn't want to retype.
Do you have the other changes you're talking about here?
Well, those were all making it more stringent, so they don't need to be mentioned. And I don't think these two changes were making it less stringent, but I think that you should have findings clarifying that.
Okay. A motion?
Motion. I move that we accept this negative declaration as amended or modified by staff.
I'll second it.
Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. Now we can go to the order.
Move the order as changed. Second. As discussed.
Okay. Do we need to have those changes described again so that we're very clear?
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah, let's make sure we have
it. It would be deleting item 1E, which is under the therefore be resolved, which is the paragraph on non-concurrence. It would be deleting the skid trail language from the order and placing it in the soil disturbance factor. It would be adding a requirement that the forester notify the regional board staff concurrently with CDF when applying for a major or minor amendment. Would state that for all tier two and tier three for the next 3 months, require tier three monitoring for the next 24 months. Excuse me, not next 3 months, next 24 months. And then Lori had some language on the eligibility criteria. You can't go lower, but I don't remember the exact language. Did you type it right?
Did anybody write that down?
Yeah. If you would, please. Essentially, language saying that the eligibility criteria for the THPs or NTMPs that are categorized by the eligibility criteria in tiers 2, 3, and 4 could not go lower in their monitoring programs. But Lori had some very
less stringent,
well,
I think was the
yeah,
right.
Less stringent.
We'll make it appropriately eloquent next week.
Okay, so those are the changes.
There's more.
Oh, there's those are the changes to the order. There's changes to the monitoring reporting program that year one will be put in quotations so that it's clear what it means. Oh, and that you wanted the cumulative effects ratio. I mean, excuse me. No, that's it. Just those two things. Oh, that's right. Into the monitoring and reporting program, the ground-based equipment. For winter operations, ground-based equipment off an all-weather road, they would have to comply with Tier 3 requirements.
And the 15-year...
That's a change to the cumulative effects ratio.
Right.
Okay.
And then the other one was the thing you'd mentioned about the water quality monitoring for Tier 2 and Tier 3.
For 24 months?
Yeah.
I mentioned that.
Yeah, okay.
And did you mention the requirement for the forester to...
Yes. To notify us? Yes.
And did you...
It just seems to me this winter ops thing, to limit it to Tier 3, there might be other criteria that would bump that particular timber harvest plan to Tier 4.
Yeah, and that's all taken into consideration.
Okay.
Sorry? It's all taken into consideration, not stuck in Tier 3. They can be bumped to Tier 4.
Okay, well, the way our language is.
No, it doesn't say
no,
that it's
it starts
only
out. They start in Tier 3.
Okay. Automatically at least at Tier 3. And
so
then
it just needs to be clear that it doesn't limit it.
Automatically at least Tier 3.
At least would be good.
So using the word at least.
But it's not automatic that it goes to Tier 4.
No, that's exactly right.
That's
that
what
the
we're
whole
trying
point.
To prevent.
Yeah.
I mean, it could if the executive officer feels that it needs to go into that category, but it's not a default into that category. Okay. Any other changes? I think I did have a second.
Yeah.
Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passes. Thank you and good night.
Thanks, everybody.
Yes, thank you.
And thank you, board. Very diligent.
Well, you summed it up wonderfully.